This is Steve Maxer conducting an oral history interview with David Martin on the 9th of March, the year 2000, at 10:45 a.m. in the Special Collections Library interview room. All right. Mr. Martin, if you would start by giving us a brief biographical sketch of yourself, when and where you were born, where you went to school, and then we'll talk about training and preparation for Vietnam.
Okay. I was born and raised in Lubbock, Texas. I went to P.F. Brown Elementary School, went to O.L. Slayton Junior High, went to Coronado High School until the 10th grade, and that's when I quit school and volunteered to go into the Army. While I was growing up in Lubbock, virtually the main thing that I did as a teenager was roller skating in Carlisle and played with the roller hockey team there.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you decide to leave school in the 10th grade?
I would say that I was probably a little bit rebellious and I thought that I knew everything.
Okay. And why did you decide to join the Army? Of the services?
The Army specifically? Mm-hmm. My father was an Army veteran of World War II. My grandfather was a World War I veteran, so it was virtually a family tradition.
Wow. Okay. When you joined, did you anticipate going to Vietnam? And what year was this that you joined?
I joined in 1967.
Okay.
March of 1967. Mm-hmm. I knew that there would be the possibility of going to Vietnam. At that point in time, I don't think there was a big buildup in Vietnam like what happened later. I mean, I know there was a lot of men there, but it was in the back of my mind that I might have to go.
And how old were you when you made this decision?
I was 17.
What did your parents think of your decision?
They would have preferred that I had stayed and finished high school. But with my determination, they blessed my decision and supported me in it.
Now, since you were 17, did they have to bless your decision by signing?
Yes. At that point in time, if you weren't 18, your parents would have to sign for you. So, yes.
Was there any discussion, or did they try to seriously dissuade you, or did they realize you had made up your mind and that was it?
We had some discussion, but I think, especially with my father, we were very close, and he being a veteran, and like I say, I at that point in time, I felt that I knew everything. I was somewhat rebellious. Not the best teenager around, not the worst, but I think that he felt that it would be a good learning experience for me and teach me some discipline.
Were they worried about you going in at that time with Vietnam going on?
I think they had reservations, knowing that the Vietnam conflict, but there again, after we had discussed it and everything, I think we all decided that it was probably going to be the best thing to do, and hopefully I wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. Okay. At that point in time, was our thoughts.
Okay. When you enlisted, what did you enlist for? Was it to be infantry or?
I originally enlisted for airborne, and I couldn't make airborne because of my back problems.
Okay.
So the Army was kind enough to send me to artillery school in Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Once I completed basic training.
Mm-hmm. So, when did you actually enter service and go to basic training? What month and what year?
March 19th, 1967.
Okay. And you went to?
I went to the reception center in Amarillo, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Bused us to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, beautiful Logan Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I had my basic training.
At Fort Sill?
Right.
Okay. And
Fort Bliss.
I'm sorry, Fort Bliss.
Right.
Okay, Fort Bliss. What was basic training like?
It was a rude awakening, especially for someone that thought he knew it all. Mm-hmm. I realized real quick that, you learn teamwork real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a rude awakening to go into the discipline of mm-hmm. the military mm-hmm. routine.
Mm-hmm. What was the hardest thing about basic training?
Probably at that point in my life was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, so early wake-up call.
Right.
All right. What was the next hardest thing?
I think that the rigorous activities, I mean, while you were training, because you did go from 5 o'clock in the morning until 6 or 7 o'clock at night, sometimes longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you're young, it takes a little getting used to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned on a questionnaire here, I asked you about discipline. You mentioned that was a difficult thing to grapple with, the new discipline of the Army. You mentioned the teamwork in that response that you gave. But I was curious if there was any kind of physical contact between drill instructors and trainees. How did they treat those soldiers that weren't so pliable?
You had people that if they didn't do what the drill sergeant said, they were disciplined. I don't think there was any... I never saw any physical contact between someone in training and a drill sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
There was plenty of verbal abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a couple of guys not make it through basic training.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And that was, I think he had drill instructors would pick out the weaklings of the bunch or what he felt was the weaklings
mm-hmm.
and would go. But I had I was fortunate in maybe not having a rigorous as basic training as some, because I found out after I was in basic training, 2 weeks into basic training, that my drill sergeant had been stationed in Okinawa with my brothers. And they got along, thank God.
So after that... Did you notice a difference?
Excuse me?
Did you notice a difference? Certainly. Before this drill instructor knew that you were a friend's brother, and then after he knew that you were a friend's brother, there was mm-hmm. a difference in the way he treated
definitely.
Really?
I had a friend that was from Oklahoma that I met going to basic training that was from Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
When we found this out, all of a sudden when Sergeant Galvin would have CQ duty, he'd call me. Well, if you had CQ duty, you got off the next day.
Yeah.
You didn't have to go do your training. So every time Sergeant Galvin had CQ duty, I was CQ runner.
Okay.
And my buddy kind of was on my skirt tail, so he got out of a lot of that, the normal activities that you would have to do. A good example of that would be going to the firing range, coming back, cleaning weapons. Sergeant Galvin would tell me, Martin, you and Cum will give your weapons to someone, have them clean them. You check the weapons in. So we would check everybody else's weapons.
Did the other soldiers you were going through basic realize?
I don't think so. Don't think they ever realized it, other than Cummel.
Yeah, your buddy that also happened to benefit from your association.
Right, right.
Did you ever feel guilty that you were getting special treatment?
No, not at that point in time. I was thankful. Uh-huh. Like I said, I'm just thankful that the Sergeant Galvin and my brother had good relations uh-huh. as opposed to bad relations.
Right.
which would have made it miserable.
And how did you find this out? How was it? How did it come about that
my brother was stationed at Fort Bliss?
Okay.
Also at, okay. at the time, and he come up after 2 weeks after I was in basic training, mm-hmm. and saw Sergeant Galvin, and they started reminiscing. And so basic training, as far as I can say, was pretty nice. I think mm-hmm. I mean I pull KP, the stuff that you did back then. You know, it's not like the Army today where you don't pull KP. But it was somewhat easier.
Mm-hmm. Back to the question about discipline, though. Would they use different techniques like push-ups and squat thrusts and, you know, with physical?
Mainly it was like push-ups were really dreaded. I mean, that was probably the, you know, for minor infractions, you know, smiling at the drill sergeant, you know, 50-100 push-ups, mm-hmm. whatever. If someone did something really bad in the barracks on Logan Heights, they were built in a rectangular pattern around a paved area that they used as a morning formations drill field, etc., and it was paved. Mm-hmm. Needless to say, that time of year was very warm in El Paso. And for major infractions, someone might be told to run around that area for 20 times with their rifle up above their head, mm-hmm. and which was bad.
Mm-hmm. That was the worst punishment that you
witnessed? I think that's the worst that I saw mm-hmm. people get. And mm-hmm. I mean, you'd have guys that would pass out and mm-hmm. suffer from doing that. Mm-hmm.
What about group punishment?
There again, that's how you learned your teamwork. I mean, mm-hmm. You know.
Were there ever incidents where you were
punished? Oh, yeah. You know, the squad would get in trouble for something, and you were... you couldn't leave your barracks, you know. Mm-hmm. Weekend passes pulled for someone doing something in a squad. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was not unusual. And that was a way for them to train you to do the teamwork and work together. Mm-hmm. And you learned real quick that if you had some stragglers, you did your best to keep them going.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of stragglers, or I guess guys that had a hard time adjusting, were there ever any incidents of blanket parties or
short sheets? I mean, you know, that was probably the worst thing that I ever saw.
Okay.
Short sheeting someone.
No GI showers or anything like that?
Not in ours.
No. Okay. What was the most important thing you learned from boot camp? Or from basic training, excuse me, going on into the Army? Do you think, in terms of its effectiveness in getting you ready for the Army?
I think the discipline that I developed when I mm-hmm. was in basic training, and that was definitely something that I needed to learn.
Okay. Anything else?
And well, the second thing I would say, the teamwork, learning mm-hmm. to work as a team.
Mm-hmm. So you left basic training... And
went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. This was still in 1967.
67. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for artillery AIT.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't make it through the first round because I caught pneumonia. It was during the summer. And
wow.
Someone caught pneumonia, so went back and finished AIT, artillery AIT, and November mm-hmm. of 67
mm-hmm.
and got orders for the 6th Cavalry Regiment at Fort Meade, Maryland.
Okay.
Which was a very rude awakening for a young man from Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah. Now, about your artillery AIT, what weapon systems did you get trained on there? Was it artillery generally or?
105 howitzers.
The 105 specifically?
Right.
Okay. No other weapons?
No. At that point in time, the Army was using the 105 mm-hmm. howitzer for its artillery training.
Mm-hmm.
Virtually when I left there, then I was put into tanks mm-hmm. when I got to Fort Meade, Maryland.
Okay. The 105, this was the towed version, the 105? They don't have a self-propelled version, did they?
No.
Okay.
It was the tow version.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what was the most difficult part of that training?
Worrying about getting your hand cut off, shoving the shells into the 105.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in your training, all you were basically focusing on maintenance of the weapon, loading
and
it, firing it.
Yeah.
You didn't have to worry about doing calculations.
No, because you had officers that mm-hmm. that was the officers would do the calculations.
Mm-hmm. And you would be responsible for inclination and declination.
Yeah, just setting the 105 up to mm-hmm. whatever coordinates he had mm-hmm. arranged, and then just, like I say, loading mm-hmm. the weapon and firing it.
Was that fear about getting your hand cut off the general fear of most of the soldiers that were in
yes,
training with you?
Yes, that was probably the worst thing that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's other things that could happen. The weapon could blow up,
Mm-hmm.
But because of the way that you shoved the rounds in, you had to use your fist, and because they're locking and loading as you're going up there, so it was a grave fear for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And one that the instructors constantly reminded you of because of the danger.
Were there ever any incidents for someone getting injured?
Guys losing fingers and stuff, yeah.
In training with you?
Yes.
A lot, or was there a couple of people, or two people?
Two or three, probably during the time. I think that was an 8-week training class.
What would happen to the guys that got injured like that? Would they be shipped home, or would they continue heal up and continue training?
Well, the first thing they did is take them to the hospital.
Well, that's good.
Say that.
That's good. Okay, so they take them to the hospital. They sew them up. Would they put the fingers
virtually
back on, or was that not possible at that time?
I don't even remember seeing.
Yeah.
Virtually, if it wasn't, for something that minor, you just recover and get back out there and go. It's just like when I had pneumonia. You just get out. As soon as you're out of the hospital, you're in the next training unit. It's the Army. You don't have time to sit around, watch soap operas.
Right, but there's a difference between having pneumonia and recovering from that. You're not minus
yeah.
any digits. And, of course, you might need those digits that you lost to perform in the military.
Yeah.
Trigger finger. So I was just curious if you knew if those guys.
And like I say, I really don't know what happened to those guys because
yeah.
they would be taken out if something
yeah.
like that happened. They were
right.
taken out.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you were real close to them, you'd never see them again. So
yeah.
you don't know if they were mm-hmm. released from the military or mm-hmm. what.
Were there any guys in your class that had been recycled from previous classes that mm-hmm. had lost digits?
That
you're aware of?
No.
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 Okay.
No.
Anything else about AIT that stands out as interesting or important in terms of preparing you for service in the Army, and especially service in Vietnam?
Well, that was my first AIT.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Then you went to Fort Meade.
Mm-hmm.
This was, now, but this time, this is still 67
December,
or 68?
December of 67.
Okay.
And Fort Meade was very cold.
Uh-huh.
Very cold.
Yeah.
Fort Meade was nice, and one aspect is you could go into D.C. and drink if you were in uniform. So at 17, I was able to go in to town in uniform, and I was allowed to drink. Which at that time, the drinking age in Texas was 21, and in D.C. it was 18.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a military uniform on,
mm-hmm.
most bartenders wouldn't mm-hmm. card you.
Okay.
So it had its advantages.
Yeah. So, actually, quick question again about training for basic and AIT. During those training periods, did your instructors ever invoke or talk about Vietnam as part of your training? the potential that you might find yourself in a combat situation, and these are the lessons that we learned. Were any of them Vietnam combat veterans?
No Vietnam combat veterans through AIT or basic or AIT.
Okay.
At that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Any discussion?
They would discuss. You know, if you go to combat, you're going to need to know this.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't. At that point in time, they weren't, using it as, when you go.
Mm-hmm.
It was if you go.
Wow. Okay.
Now that changed when I went to AIT for helicopters.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and talk about that?
Yeah, it's early. It was May or June of '68.
Mm-hmm.
I took an early out and re-enlisted to get into aviation.
What made you decide to do that?
I was in Camp Drum, New York, in the middle of the winter, and mm-hmm. I saw a helicopter fly over one day. Our tank was broke down. I was freezing.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a helicopter fly over, a general's helicopter. They had the door shut. I figured they had a heater in it. And I asked my sergeant, what do I have to do to get into aviation? And it was simple. Sign here in 4 years of your life, and we'll let you do it. And I said, fine. So after 10 months, a little over 10 months in the Army, I took an early out and reenlisted for 4 years, which got me into aircraft maintenance school
mm-hmm.
in Fort Eustis, Virginia. And virtually, once you got there, it was a matter of fact, you are going to Vietnam. In fact, it was so matter of fact as that you will probably go to Vietnam as soon as you finish training here.
Wow.
Because of the need for door gunners, crew
mm-hmm.
chiefs
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the demand for the helicopter in Vietnam versus, there's not a whole lot of demand for tanks.
Right.
That was never a consideration for you, as far as when you were thinking about switching over.
I was cold.
But you were going to be hot. I mean, you were going from one extreme to the other.
I can stand the heat. I can stand the heat.
Uh-huh.
The cold, I could not stand.
Okay. Okay. And but you weren't worried about that you were going to Vietnam.
When I made that decision, it was not thinking about, I'm going to go to Vietnam. It was how much nicer my time in the Army was going to be for me.
Okay. So you went to AIT, second AIT, for aviation, for crew chief, for helicopter maintenance in May of 1968.
Single Langeron, rotor turbine mechanic, I think is what they called it.
Okay. And what was that training like? What did that allow you to do to those helicopters? And it was the training was exclusively on the Huey, is that right?
Yes, at Fort Eustis was Huey. Virtually, you had to learn a lot about flying. We had a lot of... I think that AIT was 12 weeks long. And a lot of classroom... for the first 8 weeks. I don't think we even saw a Huey until the ninth week. But it was more learning about avionics and the various aspects of helicopters, but it was very book-wise learning.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the guys out of that would decide, I want to be a pilot. Because they had gone through so much book training
mm-hmm.
and everything for flying.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you went through, and I think at one point in time we were rebuilding jet engines, simulated jet engines, so that we couldn't screw them up too bad. And then the last 4 weeks was actual flying. Doing maintenance, doing firing runs
mm-hmm.
with the M60s and everything along the James River.
Mm-hmm. When you finished that, were at that point when you finished your first bout of maintenance training, were you actually, did you feel qualified and confident that you could do whatever it took to get to keep a Huey maintained and to work on it?
Yes. I'm very confident.
And what, how much depth could you actually go into working on a Huey? I mean, was it...
Everything except for rebuilding the engine transmission.
Okay. I mean,
you know, because there again, you had technical manuals that you had learned to read and use and everything. But anything other than a major overhaul, you know, I felt very confident to do.
Did that include things like rotor replacement and stuff
yes.
like that?
Okay. Yeah. Because, you know, it wasn't uncommon to get rotor blades nicked up and stuff, and you were pulling them off all the time. And like I say, the biggest, I guess the biggest thing that you probably want, and that's why they had maintenance detachments to do the major repairs. But anything for up to 100-hour preventive maintenance inspection, we were qualified to do.
Wow. And that was the general maintenance routine, 100 hours of flight?
Yeah, well, you had a 25-hour. I mean, you've got your daily inspection. Then you'd have a 25-hour preventive maintenance inspection every 25 hours, and then every 100 hours.
Okay. And that was 25 hours of flight time, 100 hours of flight time?
Correct.
Okay.
Well, you do 25 hours flight time, 50 hour flight time, 75 hour flight time, 100 hour flight time.
Okay. And then you'd go back to the 25?
25.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So you finished your second AIT at Fort Eustis. And where'd you go from there?
Well, when you finished AIT, it was just a matter of when am I going to Vietnam? I was one of the few that did not get shipped directly to Vietnam from Fort Eustis. I mean, it was, I was very lucky. And I was shipped to Fort Hood, Texas. Actually, we were at Gray Army Airfield, which is outside of Fort Hood going towards Copper's Cove. And I was shipped there with an aviation unit.
Okay.
And virtually, when you got there, you did, they had various aircraft there that, in various functions, it was pretty much a holding facility for people going to Vietnam. I got put into a unit, I think it was 55th Aviation Battalion to begin with, and then what they did, they would set up units to be shipped to Vietnam. Well, I was from 55th Aviation Battalion, I was put into one unit. And, well, okay, Fort Hood was the 576th Transportation Company, was the first unit I was with. That was in June of 68. Then they assigned me on July the 18th, a month later, they assigned me to the 551st Transportation Detachment. And these were just the kind of holding companies. In September of 68, on the 13th of September 1968, I was assigned to F Troop 15th Cav, and that would eventually become B Troop 2nd of the 17th Cavalry.
Okay.
They were redesignated on the 25th of October 68 to B Packet 2nd of the 17th Cav, and eventually, when we went to Vietnam in March of 1969, that's when it became officially B Troop 2nd and 17th Aircraft.
Okay.
And virtually once in September of 68, once we became F Troop, we had received our new aircraft. the aircraft that we would eventually take to Vietnam.
Okay.
We had it was set up as an air cab unit at that time, and we began flying maneuvers and exercises at Fort Hood.
And what aircraft were these?
We had two UH-1B Hueys. One was a maintenance ship, and one was a command and control helicopter for the major of the unit.
Mm-hmm.
We had five Huey UH-1Hs and 10 Loaches.
Now, what were the Huey, the second Hueys that you just mentioned?
The UH-1H Hueys. Mm-hmm. They were used in the air cab operation. We would use them to carry the infantry.
Okay. Troop transport.
Right. Then we had 10 Loaches, which is low observation helicopters. They egg-shaped mm-hmm. type helicopters.
Who made those?
Hughes.
They were Hughes, okay.
Yeah, I believe the name was the Cayus, or was a name. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just called them Loaches.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had 10 Cobras, mm-hmm. gunships.
Were the Loaches armed?
Yes.
What did
they
have?
Two door gunners.
They had two door gunners as well?
Right.
Hueys had two door gunners?
Right, no. The Loaches had one door gunner.
Okay.
Crew chief.
Okay.
Crew chief door gunner.
Okay. And the Cobra gunships had both pilot and...
Co-pilot
weapons.
Yeah,
who was
right.
in charge of the weapons?
Armament. Right.
And that was armed with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, they
mini
could
guns,
either be
rockets.
Mini guns, rockets, grenade launchers, mm-hmm. the little mm-hmm. grenade launchers.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if that was a 40-millimeter grenade launcher?
It was, yes. And I think that was the main armament on mm-hmm. our aircraft was mm-hmm. the rockets, mm-hmm. the mini guns, and, mm-hmm. and the grenade launchers.
And those are 2.75-inch rockets. Something like that?
I'm not for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you get these new... These were new aircraft? Or
brand new aircraft.
Brand new, off the assembly line.
Right.
Okay. When you received those aircraft, were there technical representatives from the corporation that came with them to help you?
No. They had a pilot fly them in from Bell Helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they might bring two or three a day
mm-hmm.
Until we got all the aircraft
mm-hmm.
For the Hueys. Now, I don't know where the other aircraft came from.
Mm-hmm.
But they would just have a pilot ferry them in,
mm-hmm.
and that was it.
Okay.
Because there again, we already had a transportation detachment with us, so we had the military personnel that were qualified to do anything on, mm-hmm. on the aircraft.
Okay. So December of 1968 to March of 1969, you're doing preparations for going to Vietnam with your
Actually from September.
September, excuse me. September right. of 68 to March of 69.
Correct.
You're doing preparations with your new unit, first F Troop, then Packet, then eventually B Troop, 2nd of the 17th.
Right.
To go to Vietnam. What preparations were those? What did you do? What was the important stuff?
We ran a lot of insertions of the infantry unit.
Mm-hmm.
Just what I would call air cab type operations,
mm-hmm.
You know, looking for enemies, you know, they'd have mock enemy, and
mm-hmm.
and our Loaches would go in, and then we'd put the infantry in, and the Cobras would provide cover fire.
Mm-hmm.
And just virtually what we ended up doing in Vietnam, just with a different terrain.
Okay. Were there many combat experienced members of your unit? Some Vietnam combat experience?
I'm going to say we probably had 10 senior NCOs and officers that had been to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our pilots were about our age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the pilots back then there were many 19, 20-year-old pilots coming out of flight school. And I don't remember any of the pilots that had previous experience in Vietnam, except for Sergeant Holdidge, who was, and he wasn't, not actually Sergeant Holdidge at that time, maintenance test flight officer, mm-hmm. who had been a Green Beret in Vietnam prior to going to flight school.
Wow.
And Mr. Thompson, I believe, had been to Vietnam prior to going with B-Tree.
Okay.
I'm going to say it's no more than 10 mm-hmm. experienced Vietnam veterans at mm-hmm. that time.
And what size is the troop?
The troop strength was approximately for some reason 243 to 245 is where I remember it at. I don't know the exact number, but mm-hmm. it was 243, 245, somewhere right in there.
Mm-hmm. How many officers in NCOs do you know?
I'm going to say over half the unit was officers because of the pilots.
Mm-hmm.
We had about 30 infantry and over 100 officers. So that left like 100 aviation personnel, crew chiefs, mm-hmm. Maintenance, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in those proportions.
Okay. The training that you were doing with the troop before going to Vietnam, a lot of that live fire exercises, or was much of it live fire exercises? Any of it?
I don't think in any of our training exercises we had live fire. I mean, we did live fire training for 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The Cobras would do their training.
Mm-hmm.
The Loaches with their crew chiefs had to go through the M60 training.
Mm-hmm. But this was standard range work. You'd go to the range, fire
right.
your weapons.
Right.
You didn't actually do coordinated live fire exercise training with.
No.
And with all things coordinated and working together.
No.
That didn't happen until you got in country.
Right.
Okay.
Rude awakening.
Do you think you would have benefited from some kind of coordinated live fire exercise?
I think it would have been a great benefit. Because in reality, when you, as much as at that point in time I had thought about Vietnam, knowing that once I, in September, well, as soon as I got to Fort Hood, actually, before I got out of AIT, I knew I was going to go to Vietnam because I had over three years left in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I had an MOS that was very Vietnam qualified. And being young, inexperienced, I think live fire exercise in the United States prior to going to Vietnam would have been a great asset. To realize that it's not a game. Because up until that point in time, I really, in my mind, I think we still thought it was a game.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't realize it was a rude awakening when you got your first incoming rounds in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
when you got into a live exercise that someone's trying to kill you. It was a rude awakening.
Mm-hmm. During your training prior to going to Vietnam, did those combat veterans, those Vietnam veterans that were in the unit, did they talk about things about Vietnam and try to help you understand the kind of fighting you would be doing? And
yes.
What did they tell you?
Normally it would be encouragement that these are the things you need to start learning,
mm-hmm.
to come back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just a reality check that this is, you do need to do, this is why you need to do this.
Mm-hmm. So at least that gave a degree of legitimacy or validity to certain amounts of your training. I mean, they could invoke, listen, this will save your butt.
Right.
This isn't just training for the sake of training. This is training that could save your life.
Exactly.
And then that did help.
Yeah.
Okay. Any specific lessons that you can recall them invoking? Things that would help bring soldiers back, bring you back?
I think, if anything, the pilots were helpful to us in a when you're flying. Of course, we were the pilots' eyes and ears behind them. Mm-hmm. They couldn't see the back of the aircraft, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that became very crucial in Vietnam in tight spots when you're trying to get someone in or out of an LZ, that your knowledge how to direct the aircraft in.
Mm-hmm.
Talk the pilots through it. And I think we had an advantage because we trained with our pilots at Fort Hood prior to Vietnam. So we were very comfortable with each other, or if the pilots weren't comfortable with the crew chiefs that were assigned to the aircraft, they wouldn't be on the aircraft very long.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were there any major transitions that you're aware of? I mean, as far as having to remove crew chiefs or remove personnel and move them around, or
not any major changes that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
You know, because they're, and I think that came from the training aspect. Is the pilots really worked with the crew chiefs?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an officer enlisted man relationship as you normally see in lieutenant captains. Feel that an enlisted man's a little bit lower than them or something is how I always perceive that. I would say that was the norm, not in that situation. Whereas warrant officers, the norm was being closer to the enlisted man because they relied on the enlisted man to help them.
Mm-hmm. And most warrants were prior enlisted. No,
because most warrants were pilots.
Okay.
It was not unusual for an enlisted man to go to warrant officer school to get into aviation or become a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
But typically at that point in time, warrant officers were fresh out of Fort Walters and pilots.
Okay. So you found in your unit the relationship between enlisted men and warrants was better, stronger than the relationship between enlisted and officers, or?
Yes.
Yeah. Did that situation continue through Vietnam?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Because I think it got stronger when we got to Vietnam because being under fire and everything. I mean, you, a crew chief or a good door gunner that could talk the aircraft in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could save an aircraft from crashing. Or, you had to be the eyes and ears for the pilots, and they were worried about instrument gauges and things like that, and you were having to watch and look to see if you're going to start taking incoming, and if so, where other aircraft approaching. You had to. Let the pilots know.
Mm-hmm. So communication was a very important part of your job.
Very, very important.
Okay. Did you always get along well with the pilots that you worked with?
Yes.
Okay.
They were a little crazy. But
what do you mean a little crazy?
I think you met Conrad Graf. Some were, I would say, eccentrics.
Okay.
Young.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember the word that I think a good word to describe them is would be a helicopter jockey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some were more flamboyant than others, I'll say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you feel that the training you received in both your second AIT to be QE maintenance and crew chief through to your Fort Hood experiences in preparation for going to Vietnam. Do you think they did prepare you for Vietnam?
No doubt in my mind. They, as good as they could, mm-hmm. without live fire exercises.
Is that the, with that exception, you know, the the lack of live fire exercises, was there anything else that you could, that you thought of after you got in country that you wish they had talked about or done in training?
No, you just kind of wish that, you know, maybe I'd have paid better attention in basic or something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, then you started realizing, you know, these guys weren't just doing it to do it
mm-hmm.
when you got in country. You had a different outlook. And when you come back from country, and people would always want to know, well, what was it like and everything, you, the best thing to tell them was you need to start listening and learning.
Mm-hmm.
Because you use everything that you had learned through that point in time
mm-hmm.
as a survival skill.
Okay. So how did you get to Vietnam? You left Fort Hood...
We flew our aircraft when we knew that we were going to be going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
We flew our aircraft to Sharp Army Depot for shipment to Vietnam on ship. We were flown back by commercial airline to Fort Hood, went on mm-hmm. leave for 30 days. Then we were back at Fort Hood, and it was just a matter of the Army saying you're going.
Mm-hmm.
When that call came, we were bused from Fort Hood to Bergstrom Air Force Base, put on a commercial airlines, and flew to beautiful downtown Da Nang.
Okay. Now, did you know when you were told, okay, get your stuff ready to ship off to Vietnam, did you know at that point where in Vietnam you were going?
No, we had no idea.
Okay.
To my knowledge, like I say, we flew the aircraft out. There was a forward detachment that went with the aircraft that probably knew the ship's destination as being Da Nang. We mm-hmm. didn't know that.
Okay.
Now, not to say that officers mm-hmm. didn't have that information,
right,
but the enlisted men had no idea
okay.
where we would be going until we landed in Vietnam.
Okay.
We knew where we were in Da Nang. And it was the next morning we were told where we were going from today.
That 30 days leave that you got before going to Vietnam, what was that like?
Reckless. I've stopped 30 times in Lubbock for speeding. At least 30. And I had a good trick, see. I found out real quick that I could use it. So cops stopped me for speeding. I just bought a brand new 69 Mustang Mach 1. And so needless to say, at that point in time, I didn't know if I was going to get back to drive it or not. But when a policeman would stop me and he'd start, you're speeding, start going through the ritual, and I'd say, well, would it be okay if my parents come and pay the ticket for me? The cop and said, well, why aren't you going to be here? And I said, no, I can't be here. I'm going to Vietnam. Well, son, take care. And they'd let me off. So I learned that after a couple of days on leave. And so I used it to my advantage.
You didn't get a single ticket enforced?
None.
Every single cop that you came in contact with?
Let me go.
And you never came in contact with the same cop twice?
Nope. I was lucky.
What about interacting with your friends and family, knowing that you're going to Vietnam?
It was, I would say, at that point in time, my wife, Ginger, was pregnant.
So you were married?
Yes.
Okay.
When
did you get married?
December of 68.
Okay.
And don't use that against me. It was just a matter of fact that you're going. There's nothing you can do to stop it. I mean, emotionally for the family, it was a very trying experience. You know, but I knew I had 30 days to enjoy before I went to Vietnam, and I had heard things about Vietnam, but I really didn't know what it was going to be like, so I wanted to make sure I enjoyed my last 30 days of freedom as well as I could.
When did that leave start? Do you remember? Well, when did you leave for Vietnam? And so it's about 30 days before that.
Well, we arrived in Vietnam on March 25th. So
okay. The
leave would have started sometime in early February because we were at Fort Hood just waiting. Mm-hmm. And we found out later they were, once they had the aircraft ready and or were within a couple of days of having the aircraft together in Da Nang, that's when they moved the rest of the unit.
Well, by the time you went on leave, Tet 1968 was going on,
right?
Which was a pretty big deal. Did you and your family members talk about those types of things, or what was actually going on in Vietnam? The fact that, you know, in 1967, you got General Westmoreland telling the American people in Congress, you know, this war will be over pretty soon, lights at the end of the tunnel. Then all of a sudden, the explosion of Tet 68, a lot more cynicism and a lot more concern. Did y'all talk about that kind of stuff? Or?
You had it on news every night. I mean, it had just become a reality. And it was like, there again, because of the emotions and everything, we really didn't talk a lot about it. You know, my dad and I would talk, but leave the female members out of the conversations.
Okay. What would you and your dad talk about?
You know, things like his experiences during World War II, and because he'd been in combat and everything. So, I'd ask him things on, you know, how it was for him and everything else.
Did you find that helpful?
I mean, if nothing else, it gave me reassurance that he had made it through World War II to give me some confidence that I would make it through Vietnam.
Was he in?
And I think at that point in time, it was all with the casualties in Vietnam, especially with Tet. The question had not, you know, from earlier times, when I'd first gone in the Army, you might go to Vietnam. Then when I got into AAIT, you're going to Vietnam. And now it's gotten to the point that it's, well, will I make it home from Vietnam?
So a very emotionally trying time.
Yes.
Yeah. Your dad's experience in World War II, was that in Europe or in the Pacific?
Pacific.
Okay. So he was able to relate some experiences in Asia and dealing with Japanese fighters that were perhaps a lot more similar to what you were going to experience than, say, if he was in the European theater.
Yeah.
So that was
probably
helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. So you go to Vietnam, finally get in country. What's your first...
2 o'clock in the morning, we arrive in Da Nang. We get off the commercial airliners, leave the beautiful stewardess. You line up to get your bedding. I'm getting up towards the front of the line to get my bedding, and the clerk is behind the counter, and he's telling some guy, well, hey, 6 o'clock in the morning, there's a bunker down here, y'all go to it, because we're going to get rocketed. And I'm sitting back there, yeah, trying to scare the newbies. 6 o'clock in the morning, the sirens go off, and I start running to the bunker. Welcome to Vietnam.
And you were rocketed?
Yes. So you started to learn to listen to people real quick. Or I did.
Did you feel confident, comfortable with the guys you were going into that situation with?
Yes. I think there again, by being able to train as a unit, we'd many of us had been together for as long as 10 months training together, or in different units together, and there was a strong brotherly bond. Hmm.
Okay. All right, so you get in country, and this is what month in 1969?
March 25th, 1969.
The day, March 25th. And you go and pick up your equipment. Why don't you tell us what that was like, if there was any problems, or you get your helicopters?
No, because we had there were no problems with the aircraft, because we had an advanced detachment go over with the aircraft to make sure that they would be ready once we arrived in Da Nang. Mm-hmm. So after we received our Vietnam welcome by rocketing... that morning, we picked up, had chow, and virtually went out to the flight line, picked up our aircraft, and flew to Camp Eagle, which is just northeast of Fubai.
What was your first experience at Camp Eagle? What did you do when you first got there?
Virtually, you go find your bunk. Company area was brand new. Our hooches had just been built. They had not been sandbagged. So you virtually just got up there and get settled in on the 25th. And probably for a couple of days, we were just getting the transportation detachment set up. I don't think we flew the first 3 or 4 days other than flying up to Camp Eagle. And so it was virtually, they gave us a couple of days to get settled in. The crew chiefs got acclimated to the maintenance areas and did a good check of your helicopter and everything. And got your live ammunition and things like that. But just... getting prepared for being put into action.
And how long was it until, from the time you got to Camp Eagle until you went on your first mission?
We arrived at Camp Eagle on the 25th of March. We were flying by April 1st. We had our first KIAs on April 5th.
And these were guys that were in your troop that were killed?
Yes, it was we had inserted the infantry unit into a hot LZ, and virtually they took incoming, friendly incoming, killed five of our infantry guys.
Friendly?
Friendly fire.
Where was this friendly fire coming from?
It was 105 howitzers, bad coordinations. So needless to say, that was a rude awakening for the whole unit at that point in time. 10 days in country, 11.
First,
we had five KIs.
And your first casualties were the result of fratricide. What did that do to morale?
It killed it. There again, I think it was an experience of learning Vietnam. And that you couldn't, and I hate to say this, but it's true. You start getting survival instincts, and you start to feel that you can't trust anybody. You became, even though we went over as a unit, the Huey crew chiefs were in one hooch, the Cobra crew chiefs in another. And even though you had close friends prior to going to Vietnam, they almost became as if they had been left in the United States. When you went, you didn't see them because you were doing your job. And you become very close to a very few people that you felt would take care of you in a desperate situation.
Mm-hmm. Now, the guys that were inserted on this hot LZ that eventually suffered the... friendly kills. This was your 30-man recon platoon?
Correct.
Okay.
It was our infantry platoon.
Mm-hmm. And when you got when you went in and picked them back up after this, what was their frame of mind? What was their state of mind?
At that point in time, I don't know that. You know, that it was a bad situation. You know, yeah. I mean,
did you ever talk to them?
That's one of those things in Vietnam. You just started. It became a part of daily life. Was people dying, so you just you don't talk about it. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, the whole unit was talking about, you know, how it was bullshit that the guys got killed by friendly fire and everything else. But the reality is you couldn't do anything about it. You didn't have time to dwell upon it because you were worried about saving your ass. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was talk for a day or two, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. Then you move on.
Do you remember any of the specific individuals that were on the ground by name?
No, I do not.
Okay. I didn't know if maybe some of them were part of the Beat Troop Association now, if
well, Balthazar would have been there, and Ed Blair would have been in with those guys.
Okay. So that's J.R. Balthazar and,
right.
and Ed Blair.
Right.
Okay. You mentioned, I asked a question on the questionnaire, weapons and equipment did you used and whether or not they were adequate, and said you have the general compliments of an aircraft unit, but mentioned something about maybe using or having a bigger gun. Do you think that I think it's a very important point about looking at the Vietnam War in terms of tactics and strategy. Do you think having bigger guns or killing more people would have helped?
Well, back to the guns.
Mm-hmm.
I think as being in an air cavalry unit, we had access to probably, you know, the best weaponry in the world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We could call in Phantom jets strikes,
mm-hmm.
Navy artillery mm-hmm. from ships off coast.
Wow.
So, you know, really, I think we had adequate firepower. Naturally, if you had killed all of your enemy, you know, you would have been more effective. But because it was a guerrilla warfare type operation, you didn't know who your enemy was.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know.
How much of that did you understand at the time when you were in Vietnam, as far as that, you know, what was going on in Vietnam in terms of this is, you know, the insurgency aspect, the guerrilla warfare, the interaction between North and South forces, the Viet Cong and PAVN? How much of that were you made aware of?
Well, politically, I was not as educated as I wished I had been.
Mm-hmm.
The reality was that in daily life in Vietnam, you become to not distinguish between South and North Vietnamese. They were all the enemy. And that is, when I talk about survival skills, that's one of the things that people survive that I talk to
mm-hmm.
learn
mm-hmm.
and acted as any Vietnamese is your enemy.
Mm-hmm. And when you say any Vietnamese and they all, are you including women, children, old people?
Certainly. I was probably more scared of children and women than men.
Why?
Because I had a mental thing about guys. It wouldn't bother me to blow a gook away in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
excuse me for my terminology, but at that point in time, they were, I considered them gooks. I'd have blown a guy away in a New York minute. I didn't know if I could do that with a woman or a child. Hence, I become very more, a lot more cautious of women and children. You know, and I think one of the things that was pounded into our heads as a crew chief, you know, we had heard the rumors about kids coming up, dropping a hand grenade, blowing a helicopter up. And so you wouldn't let gooks by your aircraft. We flew Arvins, Army of the Republic of Vietnam. We had to move some of their units at times. Really didn't like that either. You know, as far as I was concerned, they were just too afraid to fight their own battle. When they get on an aircraft, they try to steal your medical bags that had morphine in them. So you were having to watch them. You go into a hot LZ, come out, they wouldn't all be off. You'd get them off as soon as you could after getting out of the hot LZ, but it was a different experience.
You had incidents where taking Arvin units into combat, they would, if the LZ was hot, they wouldn't get off the aircraft.
Some of them wouldn't. So when we get out of the immediate area, no longer firing the M60s, we'd get the gook and throw him off.
Did that happen? How many times did your unit support those types of operations with Arvin? Was it frequent or infrequent? Or
we, prior to going to Chu Lai, which was in May 15, so from March, April, and May, we probably flew at least one Arvin mission a week.
Okay. And when you would fly those missions, would that type of stuff happen a lot as far as the Arvin?
It was very frequent. Very frequent.
Wow.
And that's why the crew chiefs learned what to do. And
would you and your fellow soldiers talk about those types of things? I mean, here you are. Yeah, you're
certainly
a country.
No doubt about it.
What would you, because, what would you talk about?
You know, and here again, we're young. We don't know the political situation. But it was disheartening to know that even the South Vietnamese, we felt the South Vietnamese did not want to fight for their own cause. So then we got a mindset, what's it all about? Why are we doing this? And you get real quick into a mindset. You forget about all of that because the one thing you're trying to do is survive one day at a time.
Any other interesting missions from your Camp Eagle days?
Well, from Camp Eagle, we, of course, flew the Eshaw Valley.
Okay.
Which was triple canopy jungle type atmosphere. We'd do long-range reconnaissance patrol insertions, extractions.
These were the guys in your unit, your cap platoon? These were other LARP units?
LARPs.
LARPs
were LARPs, man. They were a different breed of cat. They were almost like the Australians, born to kill, and they loved what they did.
How much interaction did you have with them?
Well, you would...
Besides picking them up, flying them, and bringing them home?
Typically, the only way you got in with LARPs are... I'll say Australians, is if you went in and got them out of a hot area, and then they were somewhat appreciative, and you might have a few beers with them if they saw you someplace and they'd buy you a beer. But virtually, really, no close interactions. I mean, we knew what the LARPs did and respected them for that. and would try to do as much as we could to help them. Mm-hmm.
What else did you do in the A-Shaw?
Just normal. Well, and I say normal. Normal for Vietnam missions, you know, we firebase support. Mm-hmm. You know, we might resupply firebases. Mm-hmm. It was virtually whatever you were called to do. Mm-hmm. But mainly we were search and destroy type operation. Mm-hmm. Try to locate the enemy. Once they're found, then we'd insert the infantry platoon and hopefully get a body count for the day. That was our goal.
When you say a body count, would that be an on-the-ground confirmed count or?
Confirmed.
Confirmed how?
Right. A lot better if you can confirm it. Uh-huh. And even better, you get an A+ if you bring the bodies back.
Okay. And would that be bodies with weapons or just bodies?
Bodies, weapons, anything that you could find. Mm-hmm. That naturally you wouldn't leave anything on the ground that the Viet Cong might have access to that they could use against you. Mm-hmm. In the A-Shaw, it was nothing to see a cobra put rockets through an elephant. Water buffalo, blow them up with grenades. They were pack animals for the Viet Cong, so you wanted to get rid of them. It was no worse than blowing up a truck.
What was the first experience you had with enemy contact? Yeah. Barring the first experience of casualties due to friendly fire. What about your first incident with enemy fire, enemy contact?
First hot LZ. I mean, probably within that first week, mm-hmm. because that was there again. It was, we were to find enemy, and mm-hmm. typically, if we were putting our infantry in, that's because we had found enemy.
And what kind of resistance did you meet?
Normally, we'd have small arms fire. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes we call them yak-yak guns. Mm-hmm. They were double something that mm-hmm. were, I guess, anti-aircraft type weapons. Mm-hmm. But I think the majority of my flying experience with weapons was small arms fire.
Mm-hmm. What about RPGs?
We had, well, typically your Loaches were hit with RPGs because they were lower to the ground and everything, and of course they'd be more accurate. So, you know, but it was definitely always a concern.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particular weapon that you grew to fear most, enemy weapon that you grew to dread most flying in a helicopter? Or was it just anything that they were firing at you?
It was that one little bullet coming, you know. Mm-hmm. If that was the one that got you, that was the one that you'd be most worried about. I mean, mm-hmm. they were all to be worried about.
Right.
You know, just like us as being in aviation, you had a flak jacket. We sat on ours mm-hmm. because typically when we were shot at, it was from below.
Right. The reason I ask is, you know, in previous wars, certain weapons were dreaded most, like in World War II, the German 88. I mean, ground infantry dreaded that weapon the most. So it's just, I'm curious if there was one that helicopter pilots, crew chiefs, if there was one particular weapon that you grew to fear, because you knew that was it. If it was, if you got hit with one of them, it was all over. So, okay.
Well, because like an AK-47 round could down a helicopter, mm-hmm. and which could kill everybody inside. So right. I mean, you know, it was just as deadly. It could be just as deadly mm-hmm. as say an RPG.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay. Naturally, if you're going to be shot at, the smaller the bullet would, mm-hmm. you know, that would have been my preference.
Mm-hmm. The first couple of months that you were in country and you were doing your operations in the Asia, what was the most difficult operation that you undertook? The one where you met most resistance?
Well, I'm going to say in early May, just before the Hamburger Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Hamburger Hill was started May the 11th, I think, which we were in the initial assaults, and that was building up to be a major battle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the most firepower I had seen the Americans put into an operation since coming to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And then on May 15th, we were shipped to Chu Lai.
Okay.
For a temporary duty assignment in Chu Lai.
Any major aircraft losses during your time in the Asia?
Well, our 10 Loaches that we went over with within the first 60 days, all 10 had been shot down.
Wow.
It was not unusual to have a Loach shot down and recover it, and it could continue to fly.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were destroyed when they crashed also. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you were always getting new Loaches in because they caught the heaviest ground fire because they were the ones that found the enemies for us.
Mm-hmm.
And they flew treetop level.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, when they did crash, they weren't falling that far. So that mm-hmm. was an advantage for them.
Mm-hmm.
But also not to say that's a good advantage. I mean,
less time to auto-rotate, though.
Right. But, but if you're falling through trees and stuff, it kind of broke the flaw.
Yeah.
You know, we'd go in and recover aircraft. It was nothing to see the infantry guys walking out with the tail beam or something like that in their arm, you know, because whatever we couldn't get out of there, you'd go in to recover. If an aircraft got shot down, we'd have to put our infantry in to recover the crew and any equipment, especially the radios,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Right.
And then if you couldn't get it all out, then the Cobras would end up blowing it up.
Hmm. Because you didn't want to leave anything for the enemy.
No, exactly.
Okay. And while you were working in the Asia and doing your helicopter maintenance and taking care of your aircraft and everything else, at that point, were there any kind of technical representatives from the helicopter companies working with you, trying to help you solve problems with aircraft, things like that, or was it all just Army in-house stuff?
At that point in time, it was all Army. Mm-hmm. If you needed tech reps and stuff like that, civilian tech reps, you would take typically... The preferred solution was to get the aircraft to Da Nang.
Okay.
And that's typically for the Northern I Corps.
Mm-hmm.
That's where your civilian tech reps were.
Mm-hmm.
There again, flying all day, I wasn't in the rear to know if these guys came or not. I'm sure mm-hmm. that they did,
mm-hmm.
Since we had a transportation detachment that... could perform any major function on an aircraft. So
mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's times when we had to get tech reps in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you got assigned this temporary duty in Chu Lai. Why did your unit get tasked with that? What was the major operation you were doing down there?
The AmeriCal division had gotten heavy resistance from NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And they needed additional air cavalry support. And there again, the air cavalry unit can get into an area and out rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they needed that type of support. So we were moved to tents in between. In July, there was two Phantom runways, Marine runways. In July, we slept in tents in between them. And to July, they put us in tents in between the two runways in July, and that's where we'd stay at night. We had a staging area in Tam Key so that we would be closer to the area of operation so that we could respond quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So our daytime was spent in Tam Key mm-hmm. waiting to react.
Okay.
Our maintenance detachment was left at Camp Eagle at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So any major maintenance, which that would be 100-hour PMI,
mm-hmm.
we would fly the aircraft back to Camp Eagle
mm-hmm.
For that maintenance.
How long would that take, flying it back to Camp Eagle?
Camp Eagle was probably a couple of hours flight time. Because Camp Eagle was like an hour from Da Nang, and it was probably about another hour down to July mm-hmm. flying time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Quick question back to your time and while you were working the Asia Valley and the first 3 months that you were in country. We talked about the body count, hopefully getting bodies, hopefully getting weapons. Did you find that your body counts were at times high, or was it what was the most that you recall?
5 NVA mm-hmm. would be a high body count.
Okay.
Confirmed body count.
Mm-hmm. And would those be bodies you brought back, or
yes?
Okay.
Yeah.
And these are NVA regulars wearing North Vietnamese Army uniforms. You know, we're not talking about Viet Cong and black pajamas.
No. We're talking hardcore NVA.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That would be a high body count.
Okay. Did that change when you went down to July? Was there more action in July, or?
There was definitely more operations and resistance at that time mm-hmm. in that area.
Okay.
Not to say, I mean, you know, at various times in the Ashaw Valley there was heavy resistance, but at that point in time
mm-hmm.
There was very heavy resistance, NVA resistance in that area.
Mm-hmm. And when you worked in the Chulai area in support of the AmeriCal division, this was primarily inserting them into areas, or what kind of operations were you?
No, well we and you had Marines in that area also. There was I don't remember how many Marine units, but we used the Marine mess halls while we were down there. But you had the AmeriCal division had heavy infantry units in the area of operation. We were providing support for them. Whereas if they got into some resistance or something, we might put our infantry unit in behind where they thought the enemy might be or mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you were going into those types of situations and into combat, were you briefed on what kind of unit you might encounter? Did you know, for instance, if it was a PAVN or if it was Viet Cong, or was it just enemy?
Well, that was one advantage of being in an AirCav unit. We had radios, and of course, being a crew chief, I had a headset, a helmet, and we virtually listened to the majority of air traffic from our aircraft. So if we had a loach that was on the ground, we might be 10 minutes away or 5 minutes away. If they got shot down, we knew it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So we were very aware of resistance when we went in, by the time that they would take the Hueys into an area.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we knew when we were going into an LZ, with pretty good certainty whether it was going to be a hot or a cold LZ.
Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't know whether or not you were going to be encountering a hot LZ. The opposition was going to be hardcore North Vietnamese PAVN or Viet Cong. You wouldn't know the makeup, the disposition of the force on the ground that's opposing you.
No, no. And you wouldn't, there again, a hot LZ, you know, you're receiving incoming as you're going in. You don't know how much, how hot that LZ is going to be. You know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, was it during your time down near Chu Lai that you were involved in the Lamar plane?
Yes.
The operation? Why don't you discuss that and, I guess, the other major operations that were significant for B Troop and the Chu Lai area?
Well, we were there strictly for Operation Lamar plane.
Okay.
Was what we were taken in for.
Okay.
And, you know, there again, we were support for the AmeriCal.
Mm-hmm.
We provided support for Marines when necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we worked the Ashaw Valley, typically if you had wounded, you would have medevac ships.
Mm-hmm.
The casualties were so great in the Chu Lai, in the area when we were in Chu Lai, that we ended up pulling a lot of medevac missions.
Wow.
So we would, more than, I would say, in the Ashaw when we were there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, typically, you know, depending on the wounded, et cetera, you know, there's sometimes when the closest helicopter would go in to get the people.
Okay.
You know, whereas if it's casualties, it wouldn't really matter. You just get the first aircraft in that you could.
Mm-hmm.
So but we did seem like we pulled a lot more medevac operations in the Chu Lai area. And of course, in that time, I also flew, when our major's aircraft was down, Major Dolan's aircraft is his aircraft was down for maintenance, he would use my aircraft for command and control.
Okay.
So I had the opportunity to fly with him, and flying with him, you knew exactly what was going on because you had a lieutenant in the back with a bank of radios for communications to run artillery,
mm-hmm.
Whether you need phantom jets, artillery from the Navy, whatever. So
mm-hmm.
you when you flew with him, you knew exactly what was going on.
Did that happen frequently? Did you get to do that a lot? Or?
Well, yeah, because, you know, there again, his aircraft every 25 hours had to be down for at least one day.
Yeah.
And Major Dolan, I compare him to Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now. He really was like that guy, he, you know.
Hmm.
But he seemed, and I'm going to say at that point in time in my life, he seemed glory hungry. But there was one good thing about Dolan. He'd never make you do something. He would always ask you, do you want to do this? You know, but being a Spec 5 crew chief, how are you going to tell the major who's flying your aircraft, no, I don't want to go into this area to do something?
Mm-hmm.
You know. But it was interesting flying with Major Dolan.
Can you give me a specific example maybe of one of the, I guess, crazier types of requests he made of you?
We were working in an area, and we got into a village that we could see some weapons and stuff on the ground, but they were scattered out. And in fact, in the Chu Lai area, we recovered quite a few AK-47 still wrapped that had never been used. So souvenirs were nice to have. But Major Dolan asked me, you know, he says, Martin, if I sit down, you know, if I put you down, will you go pick up these weapons and stuff? You know, I had to think about it for a minute. You know, what am I going to tell him this time? They really didn't want to do it because you'd heard of all the booby traps where they put weapons out like that, and you go to pick them up, and boom, you're dead. So I told him, I said, well, Major Dolan, if you'll keep the aircraft on the ground while I go out and get them, I'll be happy to. He didn't do it that day, so...
Okay.
But I was flying with Major Dolan when I got my DFC. I mean, he was just, you know.
What were the incidents surrounding that when you got your DFC? You're talking about the Distinguished Flying Cross?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. We were, we heard a call for a medevac. And, of course, there weren't any around, and we were close. So it was a Marine battalion that had been pinned down, had heavy casualties. So, there again, they'll ask, you want to do, all the crew, you know, you all want to do this. And, of course, our response was, we're the closest ones. Let's go. So we went in to the area that was it was hot. I mean, there was heavy resistance. And when we got in, we couldn't make a landing because the tree stumps and everything had been blown away by stuff. And, it was just tree stumps.
Mm-hmm.
Up in the air that were broken off and stuff. And so I had to get out on the skid and load three wounded patients on board. And we took them back to the medical hospital in July, and then we went back, and the Marines were, of course, pinned down, and they couldn't move because they had casualties. So since we had already been in the LZ and knew the situation and the LZ with not being able to land and stuff, we went back in for five more casualties again.
Okay. And that's, and for that action, you were aware of the Distinguished Flying Cross?
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, because I had to get out on the aircraft skid under enemy fire and
mm-hmm.
all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You just do what you did. I'm not a hero. You know, I did what I had to do to get out of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anybody would have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
How long were you working in the Chula area?
We ran operations in Chula from May 15th till the end of August. And at that time, I was transferred to Company B, 158th Aviation Battalion at Camp Evans.
Okay. What did you do there?
Well, when I got in up there, they asked me if I wanted to be a crew chief, and I'd been crewing for about 6 months by then. And I said, it was either be a crew chief or go into night maintenance, and I went with one of the guys that had been with a friend of mine that had been with me at Fort Hood all the time. So we both went up there, and they had a spot where we could both do night maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd seen enough action by that time that sounded awful sweet to us. And so we opted to do night maintenance while we were up there.
Okay. How long did you do that?
Right at the end of December, and then I took a crew chief. I became a crew chief for a colonel that was over a Chinook battalion. He had just gotten a Huey and needed a crew chief, and so I volunteered to do that.
Okay.
So I did that my last month that I was in Vietnam.
Okay. And then you left Vietnam when?
When?
When did you leave Vietnam?
January 5th, 1970.
Okay. Now, I guess in your overall experiences in Vietnam, what was the most heroic, most brave thing you witnessed?
You know, there again, that's hard to say, Stephen, because there were so many incidences that it became to where you felt it was just part of life or part of your daily routine for people to do things.
Mm-hmm. What examples stick out?
A lot of times we weren't, I guess if anything, I felt compassion for the guys that were in the infantry unit.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew what they had to go through. Not to say that Vietnam's good, but being a crew chief in Vietnam, being able to at least get back at night and sleep in your own hooch and everything had some advantages.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess the most heroic thing to me is those guys just going back out day in and day out. After going through the things that they did with the five guys killed. The infantry platoon received heavy casualties. The most heroic thing that I know of that I wasn't there was the Doc LaPointe.
Mm-hmm.
But that's after the fact, knowing what went on.
Would you explain what happened there? From what you know, as far as
you're told? Here again, our infantry unit had been inserted.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is in the Chulai area, or
right. This is when we were. It's June 2nd, 1969.
Mm-hmm.
The infantry unit had been inserted. They got pinned down by an enemy bunker, and when the enemy first opened fire, they wounded two of the guys that were up front, and Doc LaPointe. Once they were wounded, even though the enemy was still firing and everything, went out to try to give aid because that's what he was. He was a corpsman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was shot numerous times. And then he ended up finally shielding one of the wounded from gunfire. And he was a conscientious objector. That's why he was a medic.
Mm-hmm.
So, here was someone that didn't believe in the war. Didn't go to Canada. He went ahead and did, served his country. And Doc was a very compassionate person. He always, the Vietnamese kids in Tam Kỳ, when we might be waiting early morning and everything, they'd come to him and he'd try to take care of any ailments and stuff that they might have and everything. But that's the most heroic thing that I know of.
He died as a result of his wounds?
Yes.
Yeah. Any other incidents or actions that you were involved in stand out that you want to talk about?
Not any specific ones that I can think of.
You mentioned being shot down. Hmm. And you mentioned something about your aircraft being shot down?
No, my aircraft crashed.
Your aircraft crashed.
When we were in Chulai,
mm-hmm.
They just moved the transportation company down, I guess, it was July. And my aircraft went in for 100 hour PMI.
Mm-hmm.
And we were getting ready to go on a test flight. Major Dolan's aircraft was going to be down the next day. So we'd finish the maintenance and test flight officer, warrant officer, was in the aircraft cranking it up, and the maintenance sergeants would fly in the co-pilot seat. And I was clearing the aircraft. I checked the left side of the aircraft, and then I checked on the right side, and I saw Major Dolan's crew chief coming up waving his hand, so I told the pilot not to take off. And he wanted me to come and help move the radios so that when my aircraft got back in, we could go ahead and go to chow and not be too late eating. And so one of the maintenance guys had been bugging me for the 2 or 3 days that we'd been doing the maintenance to be able to go on the test flight because they didn't get to fly much.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him no. But when Tom come up, and I just motioned for him and let him go ahead and take my place. And so they left on the test flight. And apparently hit a sailboat mast flying across the South China Sea in Chuai. And we went out and recovered the bodies the next day, you know, because we had to send aircraft out looking for them to see what had happened, and we found them. And then they brought a Navy ship in to recover the aircraft and the bodies the next day.
Everybody died in the crash?
Yes. Yeah.
Hit a mast. I mean, this was a
sailboat, like, yeah, a sailboat mast?
This is a daytime flight.
It was dusk. And, you know, there again, nobody really knows what happened. The inquiry board talked about pilot error. I blame myself for many years saying that if I'd have been on the aircraft, it might not have happened. But there again, I'm an experienced crew chief. I would know to look for things like that and warn the pilot. But who knows? You know, you just don't know what really happened.
Mm-hmm. Was it the main rotor that hit the mast or the tail rotor?
Yeah, the
main rotor.
Main rotor.
Wow. How tall was the mast, do you know?
Apparently they were flying low level.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, there was even talk about maybe the skid hit the water or something, you know, because there again it was dusk and the... you know, once it starts getting a little darker, your mm-hmm. perception towards water mm-hmm. and flying is not that great. So, but there's no, you know, nobody will ever know exactly what happened.
Right. And when we were on a break, you had mentioned an incident. I guess it must have been when you were actually working the ASHA early on, where there was an accident where I guess a co-pilot was killed.
No, that's... We were in Chulai.
Oh, this was in Chulai as well.
Right. Yeah, Cobra had its tail rotor shot off, and they were flying towards the runway in Chulai to try to land, because in that situation they'd have tried to landed the helicopter while moving, and then shut it down to keep it from spiraling. But apparently the pilot decided that he was going to try to turn the aircraft for some reason, and it crashed and hit a rice paddy, and the main rotor blade came down and chopped the co-pilot's head off, which when I think that's another day that I was flying with Dolan, and we went in to check what had happened, and, you know, to see if they needed any help or anything, and I had to help pick up the co-pilot's head and body.
Were there many incidents like that, as far as accidents, people being killed in accidents, or most people's injuries caused by enemy fire? attacks?
There was a high rate of accidents, but the majority, I'd say, I don't know the percentages, I would probably say 10% of Vietnam casualties might have been accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Were 90% due to fighting the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Or not necessarily enemy casualties, but result of enemy fire, but working something directly to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 96 type things.
Yeah.
Like that.
Now, you said that there were a lot of accidents. Were these accidents what were the primary causes? Was it maintenance failures or equipment failures or pilot error? What were the primary causes of accidents?
I don't want to say 10% aircraft accidents, but there was, when you're in an operation like that and you're going daily,
mm-hmm.
you're flying the aircraft daily, there's a lot of things going on. You're pushed to keep your aircraft up. It's hard to get parts. So you improvise at times if need be, to keep your aircraft flying,
mm-hmm.
within reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there again, it's the rapport we had with our pilots and co-pilots. Of course, they should do a flight pre-check. Some of them got lax because they had the confidence in the crew chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
And their feeling was, well, if you're willing to go up in the aircraft, why shouldn't I be? So. But, just because of, I think, the demand on helicopter support was so great that, you did everything you could to keep an aircraft flying.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us some examples of improvised repairs and, how would you keep that bird flying when you didn't have the right parts?
Well, bullet holes. Patch them with 100-mile-an-hour tape. Nicks on rotor blades were real. Rotor blades, tail rotor blades were hard to come by. So you would be patching bullet holes up or anything else. They could, with 100 mile an hour tape, to keep from causing further damage to the area. And and sometimes we just didn't have the time to fix it before we had to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
Mm-hmm.
So the 100 mile an hour tape was essential part of our toolbox. And that was weights on shafts and stuff could end up with bubble gum on them if they'd lost a weight on one of the tail rotor shafts or something.
Mm-hmm.
Enough bubble gum weighed the same, and it worked for a while.
These were weights that acted as like a counterbalance or a balance?
Yeah, they were balanced because going back from the transmission of the helicopter on the tail boom,
mm-hmm.
is different. About 4-foot length shafts or tubes that are connected, but they all had weights on them because they had to be perfectly balanced or they'd create a vibration for the helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the same with your tail rotor blades. They had weights on them. So, people do, tape, use 100-mile-an-hour tape and a 45 slug and to try to balance it out. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were in an area where you get the right supplies and then typically those type things would happen during the day when we're in operations, in which it was crucial to keep the aircraft up and flying at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. While serving in Vietnam, the leaders, the officers and the NCOs and warrant officers that you interacted with, did you feel that their leadership was adequate?
As an enlisted man, my attitude then was probably, the warrant officers were pretty cool because there again I interacted with them. Typically, captains, lieutenants, and Major Dolan at times could be assholes. And your mindset was, he doesn't know what in the hell he's doing. On retrospect, you realize that they did. But it's something that you didn't know then. I think we had excellent leaders in the people, in the officers that we have. We had our share of assholes, and you're going to get them.
Okay.
I think, for our unit, I think we had good officers.
Okay. So you came back to the United States in January of 1970.
Yes.
You still had 3 years left on your term of service, correct? Or two and a half years.
2 years.
Okay.
Should have been two, yeah.
Two years left on your obligation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you stayed in the Army for 2 more years.
Uh-huh.
When you came back to the United States, what was that like?
Well, I had to leave Vietnam on a compassionate reassignment. And my wife had some problems.
Okay.
And they went ahead and let me come back. Since I had 10 months and 5 days in country, I had completed my tour. But I would say that Colonel Carroll offered to make me an E6 if I'd come back after my leave. If I'd come back for 6 more months, but I told him I didn't want to be an E6. So they flew me to Da Nang. So I flew back out of Vietnam from Da Nang in a mail. It was an Air Force plane carrying mail. A lot of mail, too. Thank goodness. That's what I slept on coming home to Travis Air Force Base. And got to Travis Air Force Base. I was given a new uniform bus to San Francisco. And then that's when I had the rude awakening of demonstrators, people spitting in your face because you were military. And I don't know at that point in time. I'm sure they had a lot of people coming back from Vietnam come through that way, but I don't think they distinguished. They probably, some guy that hadn't even been to Vietnam, if he was in an Army uniform, would have gotten treated the same way. Once I got on the aircraft, boarded the aircraft, no one wanted to sit by me. I mean, it was like I had the plague. That was the reception you got, or I got. And I come home to Lubbock. 30-day leave, and then went to beautiful Fort Hood again.
Did Ginger go with you, your wife? Did she go with you to Fort Hood?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what, did you feel that there was a different treatment by the civilian population around Fort Hood, or did they feel the same way as the demonstrators and other people that you encountered on your way home?
No, in Fort Hood, especially at that time, everything from Temple, Texas to, say, Copper's Cove was military related. Mm-hmm. That area depended on the military, so you didn't see a lot of demonstrating and stuff mm-hmm. from them.
Mm-hmm. At Hood, were there a lot of other Vietnam veterans in your unit?
No. not a lot. There mm-hmm. were there were a few. The majority of the Vietnam vets that come back that I know were able to get out of the Army when they come back. You know, a lot of them had 2-year mm-hmm. enlistment, so by the time they trained and went to Vietnam, they might come back with 3 months, and the military would go ahead and release them. Mm-hmm. So you didn't find a high population of Vietnam vets back at Fort Hood. Mm-hmm. I know I was put in an armored unit, and I was told when I first got there, because I was on flight status, that I couldn't be a crew chief for an aircraft because they were having to train people for Vietnam. So I was given the option to either become a cook or go into armored. Well, I took an early out and re-enlisted to get out of armored, or out of tanks. I wasn't going to do that, so I became a cook. Because I left a few months early before the unit, I guess I'd been doing that for a couple of months. And one morning, in walked Miss Charles Warrant Officer McCabe, and he was in the chow line, and he looked at me, and he says, "Martin, what the hell are you doing over there?" So I explained the situation to him. Mr. McCabe had been the test pilot after Mr. Holditch got killed in my helicopter. Mr. McCabe had become the test pilot in our unit. So he asked me, you know, what was going on. I explained to him. The next day I was on the flight line with my own aircraft. So
wow.
It helps to know someone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that was the only way I would have gotten an aircraft when I got back to the States, because it was pretty much reserved for people that were training for Vietnam. I'm going to say in a unit of 200 people, there were probably like 20 Vietnam vets. Probably 10% of the people might have been Vietnam vets mm-hmm. in different capacities. And you had a lot of them that did want to go back to Vietnam. They were volunteering to go back.
Why were they volunteering to go back?
The money was great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get back in 69, I think I made $3,000 while I was in Vietnam. Tax-free.
Compared to what you were making back at Fort Hood, which was how much?
Probably would have been a lot less than that. I mean, but the main thing was it was tax-free.
Okay.
They didn't tax you on it.
Okay.
But you got, well, like me, I got flight pay, proficiency pay, which I got that even stateside because I was flight status. But in Vietnam, you got an extra $55 a month hazardous duty pay. It was something else. It wasn't as much as the 55, but you know.
Okay.
But a lot, and then some guys just liked the experience.
Mm-hmm. Did you talk with other Vietnam veterans in your unit very often about your experiences and some of the things you had to cope with, some of the difficulties? Did you ever talk together?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you would communicate with them. And more or less you became buddies because you guys had something in common mm-hmm. compared to the rest of the guys that didn't know nothing. And it was fun to scare the other guys, too, with stories. You might do that occasionally. That's just being guys, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Mm-hmm. And was it difficult to deal with being in the garrison army back at Fort Hood after having served in Vietnam? And you know, there's the difference between being a combat and being a garrison. You see a lot of the silliness of being in garrison versus being in combat.
Typically, I know, and from the people that I've talked to, once you had been in Vietnam and you come back, Yeah. I guess you lose some of that Army discipline or respect for officers because you get a lieutenant that wants you to salute him because you're walking down the street and he's not wearing a Vietnam campaign ribbon. And it was easy to say, go screw yourself. Guy had no combat experience. Who in the hell is he? I made it through Vietnam. You can't tell me nothing. Yeah, there was a big difference. And I'm lucky I didn't get a couple of Article 15s when I come back because I had changed so much in my outlook on officers. Because when I looked at an officer, especially if he's in a dress uniform, I could tell whether he's been to Vietnam. That gave me respect for him if he had it, and I had no respect for him if he hadn't been. And that was just a personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of any soldiers that did get punished for lack of respect or disrespect?
Oh yeah, it happened all the time. You know.
For the same reason that you felt?
Yeah. But maybe theirs was, their attitude was a little worse than mine at the time. Yeah, because I mean, you learned the realities of what you needed to cope with mm-hmm. in war. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing that a lieutenant, especially the lower ranking officers. Mm-hmm. You know, major, colonel, you kind of probably had the same respect for them. But, you know, first, second lieutenants were nothing. Captains were questionable, and there again, it was just, you know, if they'd been to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you just, you know, they don't have anything to tell you that you haven't learned mm-hmm. to stay alive, mm-hmm. and that's what's important.
Speaking of Article 15s, any non-judicial punishment or court-martials in your unit while you were in Vietnam that you were aware of?
Oh, yeah.
What for?
Let's see, fragging the commanding officer or the XO, or attempting to.
What was the story behind that?
It happened when we were in July, and we had a rear detachment of people. A couple of those were, how do I want to put this? Hotheads that took the detail of ship burning. In Vietnam, they had to burn figures in barrels with diesel fuel. These guys liked to do their pot and whatever else they did and be left alone. And not too many people stood around them too much with the smell. But apparently they got high and they were going to take out the XO and chunked a hand grenade in his hooch. Luckily he wasn't there, but we had our first sergeant when we were in July, he used to go to the shower carrying his .45. He was afraid of guys going to do something to him. But you know, typically, the Article 15 type situations were people that, in my experience, they were the guys that were in the rear detachment, not going out in the field daily. Mm-hmm. Number one, infantry guys could get away with a lot of shit. It'd be hard for them to be brought up on an Article 15 because they needed them so much in the field. I think a lot of times when it came to discipline, it depended on what your MOS was. Whether you got a verbal reprimand or an Article 15.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But there again, in combat, things were a little different because officers didn't want to bring charges against guys unless they thought they could get them out of the unit. Because, mm-hmm. you know, because once whatever happened was done with, the guy's going to have a rifle or access to a lot of weapons. And so there was some, I would say there was probably intimidation to keep officers from doing things like that at times.
Any blatant acts of, I guess, coercion or intimidation on the part of enlisted men towards officers that you are aware of?
Not that I'm aware of. But there again, like I say, it's, you know, just the knowledge of it right. is probably enough.
Now, you mentioned potheads.
Oh, yeah.
Were they frequent in your unit, or pot smoking? Was that very...
you could buy a pack of pre-rolled J's, look just like a cigarette here,
mm-hmm.
pack just as tight, 10 of them for a dollar. And it was good stuff. So I would say a majority of the personnel smoked at one time or another. The people that got hooked on drugs, I think it kind of depended on their jobs, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, some guys just, because it was easily accessed, it was inexpensive,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't like the thought of getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
Did it as a way to get away from reality. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like I say, I would say a majority of the people in our unit tried it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that they did it on a regular basis. But when you pull operations all day long, you come back in and you don't know if you're going to be there tomorrow or not, you're going to do whatever you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know. I mean, it becomes a way of life.
Right.
Plus, it helps you forget where you are and what you're doing.
Yeah. With the smoking of pot, were there any like unwritten rules? I mean, obviously, it's against it's against the rules and the laws of the UCMJ. But since it was happening, and I'm sure the officers and NCOs of your unit knew it was going on, was there like an unwritten understanding or that? Okay, as long as you weren't going out the next day, you weren't flying, you weren't crew chiefing, you weren't door gunning, you know, you could get away with certain things as long as it wasn't going to put your life or the lives of your fellow soldiers at risk.
Well, I mean, it was an unwritten rule, you know, amongst everybody. I mean, you know, I'm not going to trust. Number one, you didn't trust the real potheads. Those kind of guys, you just stayed away from.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't, you know, you just don't do it when you're getting into a combat situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's okay if you smoke at night, but don't smoke during the day
mm-hmm.
when we're running operations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as you can get your ass up and get out to the aircraft and everything's okay, it's fine. When it gets beyond that, you jeopardize my life because of your bullshit, watch out.
Mm-hmm. Were there ever any incidents where that did happen?
Not that I can recall in any of the Hueys. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
it could have occurred in other areas. Just I heard infantry guys talking about various guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that they just try to avoid the person, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, you just don't want to trust yourself, you know, in a combat situation to be left
right.
to someone that's not functioning
right.
fully.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just speaking of general problems that occurred in units in Vietnam, were there racial tensions or racial problems in your unit?
We really didn't have that many blacks in our unit, which was kind of unusual. You know, I mean, we had the blacks in the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
We had some black cooks and stuff. Typically, from what I saw, was that the brothers stuck together.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like us. I mean, he found a couple of good friends that you could trust, and that was it. And with especially blacks would stay together, mm-hmm. and they didn't trust anybody else. You would find that same thing with if there were a couple of Hispanics. Mm-hmm. They would bond together. And I think it just goes back to you want to be comfortable with who you're around in that situation. Mm-hmm. There were race issues throughout Vietnam. And it was obvious to someone that was there. Mm-hmm. There was segregation, is what it was. And I don't know if that was self-imposed, because I know some of the black guys in the infantry did get along with some of the white guys and stuff. And I think a lot of it also had to do just thought on my, a lot of times from where the people came from. Mm-hmm. But there was definitely a racial bias in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. To what extent, I'm not completely sure of, but mm-hmm. it was obvious. Mm-hmm. There was no more racial than the potheads, mm-hmm. as far as mm-hmm. that, and segregation type things. So it could have been, some of it was probably self-imposed.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that came up when we interviewed a couple of other members of B-Troop during the Las Vegas reunion last mm-hmm. year, it talked about one incident in particular. They mentioned that there were some techniques employed to interrogate Vietnamese to find out information, and in particular the technique of
high level flying. It works every time,
taking a couple of them up and making one of them fly, mm-hmm. and then the rest will talk. Did that happen while you were in Vietnam? You were up?
If you sacrifice the one, the lower ranking, to get what you need from the other. It worked. When you find out something works good, you use those techniques. It's just like I was saying earlier about when you take Arvin, mm-hmm. Arvin troops into a hot LZ or something. It seemed mm-hmm. like you'd always end up with one or two still on the aircraft. Well, you got to get rid of them. It'd be nice if you can get rid of them when you're 10 feet off the ground, but if you end up being 100 or 1,000, it really don't matter. You got to get rid of them. You don't need them no more because you got to go do another operation.
Did that happen often?
Yes. Like I said, just about every time we take Arvin troops in,
but
you have that situation.
The 10 feet or the 1,000 feet?
I don't look at the altimeter. My job's to clear the aircraft.
What did your pilots think about this? Did they ever say anything to you about it, or did you guys ever talk about it?
They wanted to get the little son of a bitch off. They weren't going to land to let the guy step off. He missed his stop.
Mm-hmm. What about the interrogation techniques? Did your pilots ever talk to you guys about that, or
That was known and accepted in the unit. Like I say, it was information we needed that could be helpful, that might save one of our guys' lives. So you use whatever technique works. Because if you tuck them back in to base camp, the intelligence people are going to get a hold of them, and you're never going to get any information back. And if you do, it's going to be 3 months later.
Mm-hmm.
The more rapid we can get information, the the better off we were. Mm-hmm. And that was the method that worked.
Did your unit ever lose anybody to being captured? Do you know?
I don't think we had any MIAs.
No POWs, no MIAs?
No.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge.
Get back to the United States and what you had to deal with when you got back here. What was the most important thing you took away from the Vietnam War?
Me. And I grew up in Vietnam. When I hit Vietnam, I just turned 19 years old. I come home, I was still 19 years old, but I become a man when I was in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily all the skills that I learned there were good skills that I would use in the future. But if anything, you know, I learned survival skills there.
What was the most important lesson you learned from Vietnam?
CYA. Cover your ass. You know, it got me through Vietnam and it worked. I don't have a Purple Heart. Doesn't want one. So, you know, you learned to cover your ass. Mm-hmm. But you had, in civilian life, the techniques that you used in Vietnam are not always good. And it's hard to break those habits. Mm-hmm. When your perception is that's what saved my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to talk about?
Girls, just kid.
Did they become more important after being in Vietnam?
They were always important.
To most 19-year-old guys, they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever you want.
Well, I didn't know if there was anything else you wanted to discuss today.
No, unless okay. You want to give me a loan, and
we'll let you go.
Okay.
All right, this ends the first interview with Mr. David Martin. This is Steve Maxer conducting interview number 2 with Mr. David Martin on the 21st of April, year 2000, 9:08 a.m. in the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Martin, why don't you go ahead and begin by telling us about one of the problems with tail rotors.
Yes, you had previously asked about training experiences and possible accidents that might occur from them. And during training at Fort Eustis, after we had done our classroom training and we got on the flight line, we were warned repeatedly about the hazards of walking into a tail rotor, and especially with this being a problem being unique to aviation and helicopters. And so we were made very aware of that problem, and
were there specific accidents that occurred in training or in Vietnam, or were these mostly just secondhand stories?
They were primarily secondhand. I never witnessed anyone walking into a tail rotor. But there was, I know at Fort Hood at Gray Army Airfield, it did occur on the flight line there when we were training prior to Vietnam. And I know of incidences in Vietnam that occurred, but there again, I did not see those myself. It was reported.
And you know, did you ever witness the aftermath of an accident? A soldier that had been injured by a tail rotor?
No.
Okay.
No. But it was a known fact that was one of the hazards, and something as a crew chief and in our duties, we should be aware to do our best to keep people away from the tail rotor because of this possibility of danger.
And who were the people most at risk at walking into a tail rotor?
I would say the people that were most at risk would be like an infantryman, troops getting on and off the aircraft, not being familiar with the aircraft. I say it was probably more dangerous in training in the United States than for them than it was in Vietnam. Because in the United States, they had a tendency to where they would want to try to walk around the helicopter. If they got off on the left side or the right side, whereas in Vietnam, whichever side they got off, they were going to stay off on that side, and, especially in a hot LC situation.
Now, today, I know that part of the training when using helicopters in air mobile operations, and the units that are on the ground, the infantry units, are trained to approach the helicopter at 45 degree angles and preferably from the front of the aircraft. Did that kind of a policy exist in Vietnam where they had instituted like a standard operating procedure for those types of operations?
Well, I think it was obvious that the training would, ideal situations would be you would approach the aircraft from the side.
Right.
Here again in Vietnam, that was something that was especially an extraction would be probably where I would think that it would have been the most danger, because if you didn't have ideal situations and the infantry wasn't lined up, well, let's get four on this helicopter and four on this one, and, you know, it might end up where you had too many men on a helicopter and have to tell one to get off, and especially in a hot LZ, then he's going to be running to try to get on another aircraft somewhere, and that could have posed a real danger at that point in time.
Now, did you ever have problems with the aircraft that you flew on with the powertrain? In particular, were there ever problems with the engines not being strong enough to support the operations that you were trying to conduct?
Oh, yeah. We... one specific incident, we were in the Ashaw Valley, which were very mountainous, triple canopy jungle. We were doing a LERP insertion, and the pilot, when we had flown into the area to drop the LERPs off, had pointed the aircraft towards the mountain. And I'm not for sure how they were supposed to do it, et cetera, but we began to lose power, which I think was a result of lift, the air lift that we needed to maintain altitude. As soon as we began losing power, I was instructed to cut the ropes for the LERPs who were still repelling into the area of operation. We cut the rope and then that they were rappelling on, and then the pilot was able to turn the helicopter around and start going down the side of the mountain, and we were finally regained pitch, so we were able to get out. We were almost crashed.
Wow. Now did how far down were these soldiers on the ropes? Were they close up to the ground where they weren't injured when they fell? Or
we had some that just went out the aircraft, so they were in the, you know, they could have been probably, I'd say, 150 feet up.
And they jumped out?
No, or I cut the rope.
You cut the rope and they were about 150 feet up?
Yeah, well,
wow.
Naturally, when I cut the rope, they went down.
Right. Wow. And did Medevac have to come in and rescue any of them? Or?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, you know, there again, we regained control, and I didn't hear any of the conversations or in the area of operation, you know, on my radio that day. So I really don't know what happened to the Rangers, but it was one of those situations. It's them or, you know, them or all of us. And, and of course, they were in Triple Canopy Jungle, so that's probably laxing the fall some. I mean,
so the trees broke their fall.
Yeah.
From 150 feet. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there, were there other, any other incidents that stand out where the aircraft just didn't seem to have the power you needed?
We would get, especially because of the weather in Vietnam, you'd have sometimes you would get into an extraction and have too many troops on it. You'd have to, you know, put people off. And that seemed to be a, it wasn't frequent, but it wasn't infrequent either. It did occur on an occasional basis.
Did it engender hostility between the helicopter crews and the soldiers that you're trying to support? Or were they understanding that you just couldn't quite take them at this moment?
Well, here again, if you're in a hot LZ, it would be different than a cold LZ, where, you know. But I think with our own troops, they knew the problems. Mm-hmm. You know, because there again, it was either, you know, the gunner or the crew chief would be telling them, hey, we need one or two of you off so we can take off. Because there again, you know, if you don't get rid of one or two, nobody's getting out of there. So, it, you know, pretty much our troops were understanding. I don't think we ever had any real major problems.
Who would make that decision? Who stays, who goes? Especially in a hot LZ situation. Would the platoon sergeant, platoon leader make it? Squad leader?
Probably the squad leader or whatever. I don't remember having to physically remove anybody. So I think, you know, typically when they come in, they'd be, you know, the squad or platoon leader or whatever. Just tell someone, hey, you need to go to another aircraft. You know.
Okay.
There again, when you're telling them like that, you're kind of looking around trying to find who's the highest ranking and let them know.
Yeah. And another question about the helicopter and maintenance. As a crew chief, and you also worked in maintenance, did you ever have cause to work with one of the field representatives from Bell?
No, I never worked with field representatives. Now, you know, typically, because a field representative would have probably worked with someone from the 333rd Transportation Detachment, which did our higher level maintenance, because as a crew chief, you know, we were pretty much daily maintenance in the 2500 hour PM preventive maintenance inspection. So, You know, we would, if you had an engine replaced or a transmission, like one time I had a transmission replaced, but it was due to hitting a revetment, it was just, you know, we removed and replaced the transmission with the help of the 333rd Transportation Detachment, which didn't require any special knowledge from Bell Helicopter to bring in a civilian rep.
Okay. You also mentioned that there was an incident when an officer was killed?
Right. In the second unit that I was in Company B, 158th Aviation Battalion, because I was not a crew chief with them, I did night maintenance. So I would occasionally have to pull guard duty. And one night that I was on guard duty, we had an incident where the officer of the day was coming along the bunker line, checking bunkers, etc. And he was a couple of bunkers down from where we were at, and the men in the bunker asking for his password, and apparently he had forgotten it. and he wouldn't stop or anything. He just kept on, you know, like, from what I hear, it's like, well, you know, I'm the officer of the day, da 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 da, and kept coming at the people, and the guy shot him. And it was a spooky night, as it was. I think always guard duty was spooky over there, just not knowing what was out there. And it wasn't too much later that evening where we had an incident in front of our bunker area where we believed we had saw or heard VC. And we requested the officer of the day to come out and advise us, you know, check the situation out and advise if we could fire or set off food gas or something like that. And the officer, the new officer of the day, refused to come out to the bunker line after the first had been shot. So.
Now, was this incident viewed as an accidental shooting or as a fragging?
I would say it was accidental. I mean, you know, it definitely wasn't, you know, I mean, the guys in the bunker were protecting the bunker. They were doing what they were supposed to do. If the officer of the day had got the password, shame on him. And so as far as, to my knowledge, it was justifiable. Actions, and I don't think there was any action taken against the men that shot him.
Were there any other incidents like this?
That's the only one that I can remember, you know, being on the while on guard duty. It was an unusual event. I mean, it's just something like that would not normally happen over there. Well, I can't say that it wouldn't normally happen like that because the guy was a second lieutenant and he was new in country, and it seemed like second lieutenants had a way of getting in harm's way for some reason.
Do you remember what branch this guy was? Was he?
He was Army.
No, I mean, in terms of was he maintenance, infantry? What was he?
No, he wasn't a pilot. Pilots would, you know, guard duty. So he was a second lieutenant, and I would imagine infantry, but not for sure.
Yeah. Was the base attacked frequently, or had you recently been attacked by Vietcongians or
Patrons? Just about every night you would have, you know, someone in the wire. So, you know, that was a frequent occurrence. To have Vietcong attempting to come in and set off charges and blow things up in the middle of the night.
And why do you think the officer continued on to that bunker even though he didn't know the password? Did the soldier not warn him, halt or I am going to kill you? Or?
No, the soldier, from what I understand, gave plenty of warning and everything, and the lieutenant, I guess he took it as a game because he was probably there again. The officers that got stuck with the night duty like that were typically new in country. Mm-hmm. And you know, the only thing I can think of was he was so new in country that he thought it was a game like in the United States.
Had there ever been any incidents where Vietnamese had successfully impersonated an American officer, infiltrated a base, and then gone in and taken out a bunker?
Not to my knowledge, but, you know, being, you know, dark at night. I mean, guard duty was spooky duty. You know, I guess one of the things that used to scare me more than anything is, you know, the Viet Cong get in. You always heard these stories, you know, the Viet Cong got in, some guy was on guard duty, three guys sleeping in the bunk, kills the Viet Cong kills the three in the bunks and leaves the one that's on guard duty. And that was, I mean, it was probably a ridiculous story because I think the guy killed all four of them. But you always had these thoughts in the back of your mind, man. someone down in the bunker. I mean, you're trying to watch in front of the bunker. Now you're trying to look inside it. I mean, it was a spooky experience. Guard duty was terrible. Probably the worst duty you could have in Vietnam, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. And you said that there were some other events or incidents that you wanted to discuss today?
Oh, just the camaraderie there, between the men that served over there. And you know, it's a bond that you really, like the guys that I served with in B Troop, we were apart for 28 years. And then all of a sudden, some of us get back together. And it's like, you know, that you haven't been apart since it just seems like yesterday. And there's a bond and camaraderie between the guys that I served with. And I know, and I've seen it in other veterans organizations now, or units, where there is a strong bond that was made when we were in Vietnam. It's profound, and which I thought was very important and interesting. But it just seemed like that bond is in those hostile conditions. It's a bond that can never be broken, I don't think.
Was there anything else you wanted to talk about today?
Okay. No, thank you.
Well, then this will end interview number 2, Mr. David Martin.
This is Kim Sawyer conducting an oral history interview with David Martin on November 3rd, 2000 at 10:30 a.m. in the Special Collections interview room. This interview is part of the Lubbock Area Vietnam Veterans Oral History Project. And today we're going to ask you about the B Troop Association.
Okay.
I understand that you were a member of the B Troop, second of the 17th Air Cavalry.
Right.
And if you can tell me a little bit about the association. First of all, what is it and when was it started?
Okay. Virtually, B Troop, second of the 17th Air. B Troop, second of the 17th Cavalry Association. Is an association for any member, past or present, of B Troop 2nd and 17th Cavalry, 101st Airborne Division. Virtually, it began in 1997 when we had our first reunion at Shelbina, Missouri. I had been looking to find two of the real good friends of mine that had come to my wife's and my wedding in Lubbock in 1968 and served with me with the unit. And Jim Matthews, who's now the president of B Troop 2nd and 17th Cavalry Association, contacted me, and we virtually put together a hasty reunion in 1997, and I think it was in August of 1997 in Shelbina, Missouri. One of the two gentlemen that I was talking about, we found Arthur Ratliff, and he lived in Shelbina, so we decided to have virtually an informal reunion of whatever members we could find at the time. And we ended up having like 27 past members of B Troop show up at that reunion. So we decided at that reunion to form an association, and that's when the association was actually formed.
Mm-hmm. How did you go about finding former members? How easy or how difficult was that to actually get in touch with people to get
things
started?
It has depended on the members themselves, but typically what we started off with was a set of orders from when we were shipped to Vietnam, because we were shipped as a unit in March of 1969. So we had a basic list of 243 men that had gone to Vietnam with B Troop in March of 1969. And of course, this is right after the Army changed from the old RA numbers to using Social Security numbers. So now with the Social Security numbers, that's helped us a lot because of the use of the Internet. We've been pretty successful in 4 years. I think when we mail the Banshee Gazette now, we're mailing out a little over 700 persons that had been with B Troop at some time or another. Now, during the first reunion, we also had a couple of the guys that were with the unit in 1957 show up. So, you know, we wanted to make sure that the association wasn't just for Vietnam veterans. We wanted to go on forever as long as the units activated, and which they are to this day.
How often do you meet? Do you have an annual convention?
We have an annual reunion every year now. The times on those vary. Typically, that they're right around September, October. Like I say, we started in August. We've tried to move them around because we know that we've got members that work and everything. Sometimes it makes them hard. Farmers, you know, can't get off a lot of times during the summer. So we've tried to move those around. And but yes, we have our reunion once a year, and during that time is when we have our annual business meeting.
Could you tell me a little bit? You mentioned earlier there's a president of the organization, how it's organized and how it's set up.
Virtually, when it was set up in 1997, we elected Jim Matthews as the president of the association, myself as the vice president of the association, Randy Kunkelman as the treasurer of the association, and then we had a chaplain who, the first chaplain, was Arthur Ratcliffe. Now, those, to the present day, those are the same president, vice president, and treasurer. We're always hoping someone else would like to help, but we'll do it as long as need be.
Yeah. What kinds of activities are you involved in with this organization? You mentioned that your goal is to include not just Vietnam veterans. What kind of, do you do projects per se? What kinds of?
Well, virtually, we have a Banshee Gazette, which the Banshee name for V-Troop came about when we went to Vietnam, because every unit had call signs, and virtually Major Dolan and some of the officers were the ones that ended up coming up with the Banshee name, and that's the unit still uses that call sign today. So we have the newsletter that we send out. We have just started a Joseph LaPointe Junior Scholarship Fund, which will be used for twofold. It will be used for scholarships for Vietnamese children in Tam Kỳ, Vietnam, which we've already had have one young lady going to school in Vietnam. And then we are also setting up to have a United States scholarship fund. And hopefully we will start, that was just voted on at the last reunion at Fort Rucker. So hopefully we'll start getting a bunch of donations in for that. I know at Fort Rucker we received at least $5,250 to begin the scholarship fund. So that's going to be one of the big agendas for us. Virtually the president, Jim Matthews, and myself, we try to stay in contact with the present unit. In fact, after our reunion at Fort Rucker, we went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which is the home of the 101st Airborne Division. We attended a dedication to a $14 million medical clinic named after Joseph LaPointe Jr. And the unit, Beach Reef today has like 28 personnel. They're scheduled to go to Kosovo, in June of this year. Next year, 2001.
And you mentioned donations. Where do those primarily come from? Are these other members of
from,
the association?
From the members of the association is virtually where we get all of our funding, is donations. And we have yearly dues to help that.
Is there any possibility of grants?
Yes, we
are involved in grant writing and those kinds of things.
Yes, we talked to that with Dr. Frankel. I need to follow up on that. But yes, I am hoping to be able to get some grants started at Texas Tech in the very near future. So, I think we're all very excited that we're at the reunion about the scholarships and like you say, grants. And what we can do to help further the studies of Vietnam.
And the scholarships, how many people do you have apply for those, or what's the process, or you just...
Virtually, that has just been set up at the reunion.
Okay.
So we have a board that is going to oversee the scholarships, and... since it's so new, we still have to rearrange that board because we're going to include a member of the association officers, at least one, and then we'll go from there. But there's still a lot to be done on that, and that's, like I say, probably our pet project at the time. Other than that, I will say we are hoping to get together a barbecue picnic with the current unit before they were deployed to Kosovo, because they were very interested in that.
You mentioned you have the national reunion every year. Are there sub-chapters, for instance, a Texas chapter or local chapters or anything like that?
No, not at the present time. We've talked about maybe having many reunions in different states, trying to, now that as we locate more members, that's going to be more feasible to hopefully get like state chapters or something where the guys can get together. Various times during the year, of course, different members do get together with an informal get-together. It's not really a reunion or anything, but if they're traveling and get a chance to meet with each other, then they might do that.
You mentioned earlier about Joseph LaPointe and the medical facility.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little bit? It was named after him.
That's correct.
And could you tell me?
Yeah, virtually on June the 2nd, 1969, our infantry unit was inserted into an area where they came under heavy fire, and there was numerous wounded. And Joseph LaPointe was the medic for our unit at that time. Virtually, the wounded were pinned under an enemy bunker, and Joseph crawled to help the men, and was wounded quite a few times, and ended up shielding one of the guys, and ended up getting fatally wounded, and he died. So he received the Congressional Medal of Honor. So naturally, being a medic and with the 101st Airborne Division, being a Medal of Honor winner, then when they at Fort Campbell, when they decided to build a new facility, they would look for someone deserving that it be named after. And so that was why that facility is named after him. It was also, of course, the reason for the scholarship fund. And specifically, the reasoning for the Vietnamese portion of the scholarship funds to go to Vietnamese children from Tam Ky and that province around Tam Ky. Virtually, Tam Ky was a staging area for us. We were, at the time, we had been moved down on May the 15th, right after the initial assault into Hamburger Hill in the Ashaw Valley. We were withdrawn and sent to the aid of the AmeriCal Division in Chu Lai on May the 15th. And virtually, we lived in tents between two marine runways in Chu Lai. And so we had a staging area in Tam Ky so that our aircraft would be closer to the area of operation. Mm-hmm. And Joseph would many times, when we first get out there in the mornings and stuff, he would go over, and there'd always be children around the perimeter of the camp, and he would try to aid them with any problems that they might be having, prior to us being called out or anything. So he was a very compassionate person.
Was that standard practice to try to provide aid to civilians, or was that something really his?
This was something that he just did. I mean, typically most Americans were leery of children in Vietnam, especially, I'll say in my instance, where I was an aircraft crew chief, that you heard so many stories about a kid coming up and putting a grenade there, that you weren't really friendly. I mean, at distance it's okay, but Joseph seemed to make that a point to help the children. It wasn't something that he had to do, it was something that he wanted to do.
So your association, were you the ones who decided to name the medical facility after him, or were you involved in it, or you were approached by?
Virtually the 101st Airborne Division is who decided that. And of course we were invited to the ceremonies along with the family. That was decided by the 101st Airborne Division. I'm sure they have some process that the Army goes through on naming facilities yet. With Joseph LaPointe, there's a heliport at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, named after him. There's a building at Fort Sam named after him. Of course, that's a training for the Army medics. And I think at Fort Campbell, there's also a housing complex also named after him. So, I don't know how many medics received the Congressional Medal of Honor in Vietnam, but apparently the Army's made it don't transcribe that, Danny. But I mean, apparently they have people that can be candidates, and he must stand down.
What was the actual dedication ceremony like?
Awesome. Mm-hmm. If you're especially if you're a veteran, and knowing that your unit's still active, and the things that they went through to, you know, they have the 101st Airborne Division band there. They had a cavalry honor guard. They took very excellent care of the family. And the new Bashis, it was really nice to get to visit with them and everything. So it was just an awesome ceremony, and we do hope to obtain a copy of the Army film that they took from the 101st Airborne Division for their archive.
Again, you mentioned the new Banshees, the current current members, and you talked about wanting to involve them and do more things with them. How are you in? Is your association in close contact with them? Their members?
We're in very close contact with them. We stay in contact with the S1 officer, who is pretty much provides information to the unit. So when we send like Banshee Gazettes, we'll send them to him for distribution. We're also in contact with Captain Williams, who's the current commanding officer of B Troop 2nd of the 17th Cavalry Association, and we're also in contact with Colonel Torrey, who's the squadron commander. So we have local members that live around the Fort Campbell, Kentucky area, and that's probably one of our second main push right now, is bringing the current unit's involvement into the association, because we feel we need to do that to make sure that the association continues.
Besides the scholarship and current things that your association is working on, what do you see for the future? What are your hopes? You mentioned you want it definitely to continue with the new members, but what are some things that maybe you would like to see happen with it?
Well, I would like to see the association grow, and, you know, hopefully work on, you know, like I was talking about with the scholarships and everything, hopefully be able to get enough funding so that we can set up endowments so that the Joseph LaPointe scholarship funding could be also be indefinite. I think that's very important to us if we're going to have any meaning at all. I think that's a great way to be able to help not only Vietnamese children, but, you know, persons in the United States that need aid with schooling. And I think we'll see, hopefully, I mean, my original envision of the scholarship fund would be able to help our own children and our own grandchildren. So, you know, hopefully one day that we'll be able to maybe pay someone's way through medical school, you know. I mean, that would be great, you know.
Does your association collaborate with any other of the veterans associations, or?
Virtually, we do as much interaction as possible. Here again, where you have people that are officers of the association that have jobs and everything else, sometimes it's hard to do that. But I mean, you know, it's just like most of our members, we have members that are in the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association, the Vietnam Crew Members Association, 101st Airborne Association, DAV, Vietnam Veterans of America. So, you know, yeah, there's definitely an interaction between a lot of associations, probably not as formal as it should be yet.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell us about the association?
Yeah, everybody come to the reunion next year. Since it's going to be here in Wilder, September 21st, 22nd, and 23rd in 2001.
And what's on your agenda, the reunion?
Oh, I think we will probably visit the Vietnam Archive for a tour. And virtually that's to be remains to be set in stone yet. Typically Friday nights of our reunion, they're set up very informal. The guys get together because you've got a lot of people that might have not been to a reunion yet, and everybody shares pictures from Vietnam, movies, some of the movies like the trip on the return in 1998. So everybody's, it's kind of a show and tell on Friday nights. And then Saturday, we'll have activities planned, and of course, then Saturday night we'll have our formal meeting, and then Sunday will be more informal again.
You just mentioned the return of, in 1998. Was that
right?
A trip
that was yes, in
1998, a group of members led by Fernando de Davis returned to Vietnam with the LaPointe family, and they took them to where Doc LaPointe was killed, and that was a television crew from South Dakota went with them, and they ended up winning two awards for the documentary. And there is a copy of that in the archives as we speak.
How many members were present? Do you remember?
I think on the first trip that they went, there was 25 maybe.
Were you able?
I was not able. And, yeah, 2001 will be my first opportunity to go. So in June the 8th of 2001, we head out for, I believe it's 13 days.
And are these, is this something your group tries to do every year to organize these? Are these done with just members, or is it official? Or
I would say it's an unofficial trip, yet we posted on our webpage. Fernando de Perez set up the original trip, and he's made it very affordable for anyone that wants to go. So this will be his third year going, and I know that Jim and Judy Matthews will be going, and myself and my wife Ginger will be going along with them this year.
And also going back to your reunion, you mentioned that it will be here at Texas Tech, and I was wondering what role you play, or other members of your group play, as far as explaining the importance of preserving oral histories or memorabilia or things like that.
We've been very fortunate for the last 2 years to have 2 years ago in 98 we were able to have Dr. Franklin and Stephen Maxner attend our reunion in Las Vegas. This last year Dr. Franklin was able to attend, and we also, within the Gazette, we now have a section devoted to the oral histories, and of course the archive knows that they're welcome to submit anything for the Banshee Gazette. So we're using that as a tool to get the information out to veterans. And like I say, we on our website, there's also a link to the archives, so that if anybody visiting our website might pick up on it.
Do you find that common with your experience with other organizations, really pushing for the preservation aspect of?
I know the Vietnam Helicopter Pilots Association is, and they have made the Vietnam archives their official repository. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of associations out there that are not really pushing for that because they don't realize the importance of the oral history, and they don't understand what they could really contribute. And so I think it's just a, you know, it's important that everybody works to get that word out in whatever way we can to the different veteran organizations.
How often is the Banshee Gazette published?
The Banshee Gazette is now published 3 times a year. Prior to last year, it had been 4 times a year. But there again, when we started out with maybe 20, and we're up to over 700, and my wife and I do the mailings and everything, time constraints and everything were bearing down on us. Hopefully one day we'll be able to afford to have it commercially published. Hopefully.
Do you actually publish it yourself?
Yes.
Are you responsible for that?
I'm responsible for the Banshee Gazette. Yeah, I put the first one out in March of 1997 and have continued it. So that's my job. No one wants it. So I got stuck with it. You know, it's one of those deals. I didn't even raise my hand in that one. You got to watch these Bee Troop guys. They know how to get evasive.
Do you put a call out for people to write articles, or how do you get contributions?
We request articles from members. We also, there's a lot of members submit information for our website, so a lot of times I'll take information that's off the website, and also from other veterans organizations.
Is the Gazette also posted on the web as well?
Yes, yes. There's a section on the Bee Troop homepage where they can go to the Gazette. Mm-hmm. And I think all the Gazettes are on there, so they're accessible.
Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit earlier about the importance of the Internet. How do you think that's helped as far as contacting members, getting the news out for veterans associations?
Well, it's been a great help. It's just like when we first started our website, if you went in and looked up Bee Troop 2nd and 17th Cav on a search, you wouldn't get any hits. Mm-hmm. Today you can go in there and do it. And so if for some reason, I mean, like I said earlier, you know, I went 25 years without talking about Vietnam, and there's lots of veterans that way. So one day a guy wakes up and decides he wants to get a hold of someone he served with in Vietnam. Now at least if they put in Bee Troop 2nd and 17th, they're going to find the web page fairly easily. And that's been a big help. It's been a way that we have found some members that have found the website. And that's especially so with members, more current members of Bee Troop. We've had sign in on our guest book that, you know, might have served in Desert Storm, for example. So that's been a great help for locating members, because virtually when we started Bee Troop, we started with that original list of 243 that we went to Vietnam with. We obtained some copies of records at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. But our original intent was to find people that served in Vietnam with us. And it has grown from that. So when we go to D.C. in 2002 or prior, we'll be going back to the National Archives at College Park to look for additional orders so that we might locate other members of Bee Troop that have served since Vietnam.
Do you have committees set up as far as locating people, or is that a volunteer basis?
Virtually volunteer basis. I mean, on one person we had to get a private investigator But that was a Vietnam veteran that was a private investigator, so he did it for us for free. But it's just been different ways that we've found members, and you know we consistently are requesting copies of orders from them, from anyone that gets the Gazette, because that's been the main influx of names that we can attempt to locate. And what we have as of 4 years later, we've got roughly 157 or 1,157 names that we've identified that have served with Beatrice, but that list could go considerably higher considering the amount of time that the unit has been activated.
And when you used the private investigator, was that successful?
Yes.
Were they able to?
Yes. We used him to find the second person that came to our wedding.
So,
it was very successful. And that was finding Tom Green.
Was Tom Green very surprised when he was contacted by...
Yes, he was. Very.
Do you ever have any instances when you make contact with someone and they're not interested in...
Yes. A couple of times we have had that because there's a lot of Vietnam veterans that haven't started the healing process yet of the things that happened to them back then. So that's always a possibility, and we try to be cognizant of that and not infringe on anybody that does not want to be bothered. The Banshee Gazette goes out to everyone we've located, whether they join the association or not. So, and we advise them that we will take their name off of the mailing list if they so desire. So, I don't think we've had anybody request to be taken off the mailing list, though.
So you have a list of everyone's how to contact that's available to all your members so they can get in touch with
yes.
people as needed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a unit roster. Okay. I shouldn't say a unit roster, it's an association roster.
Okay. Right. How much are the dues for membership?
We started at $25 a year. Of course, when we first started, it was virtually... there was no association, so I funded the Gazette personally, and then we started getting donations from people we had contacted. So when we actually officially began the association, we had funds for the association. So, I mean, we have members that make considerable donations. And, of course, we are a nonprofit veterans organization, so that any funds we receive, if anyone's reading this, wants to send us a check, it is tax deductible.
Okay. Are you finding the dues are adequate to cover your expenses? As far as you mentioned, you publish the Gazette yourself. Do you have enough to cover those kinds of things?
They have been adequate, and of course, after the first reunion, we started. With the reunion registration, there's a fee in there to provide association-related items, pretty much like the jacket here. And we will be putting these available for sale in the next Gazette and on the internet. We'll have a Beatrice store, and so which will help fund the association. But so far, we've had plenty of funds. The members have been very supportive. And
do you ever do any specific fundraising, as far as fundraising drives or those kinds of things?
No, and virtually, like I say, the real fundraising will start now with the scholarship fund, and of course we're going to go to our members first, and I don't know that we'll even go outside the association. That's something that we'll, I mean, $5,000 of the original money came from outside the association, actually. It was a donation to Fernando de Paris from a gentleman that built the Medal of Honor Hall of Fame in Ohio. So, but that's going to probably be the biggest fundraising. It'll be with inside the association. I don't know that we would ever go outside the association for funding. And I'm sure if we got desperate and needed money, we probably would. We just last year made it available to have advertising space in the Banshee Gazette. And there again, we're going all over the world. Mm-hmm. But it's only 700 plus members. You know, the advertising rates right now are minimal, and it's just to help cover postage.
So you have members that are located presently in other countries?
Yes. We have members that are scattered out all across the world. Mm-hmm. And another thing that I'll get back on that you had brought up earlier was other things we were doing. Now, we've just... Fernando de Paris, and I don't know if I should say this or not, but he's an attorney for the Navy at the present time. He was the ship pilot in Vietnam, a Huey pilot in Vietnam. He is working to put together a proposal for CARE, and there's another organization that we're working with to, in conjunction with the association, because it'll only fund nonprofit associations, but we are attempting to get funds for a $200,000 clinic in Tampique, Vietnam.
And if your plans go through this clinic, will this be run by Vietnamese citizens?
It will be run. CARE, I believe it is in the process of purchasing a hospital in Da Nang. So this would be a clinic ran from that. And it's my understanding that they will eventually go in and have Vietnamese that they train to do that. Here again, this thing's just on the ground floor. So I haven't gotten all the information from Fernando yet. But it's something that's very exciting that we might be able to do, for the people of Tampique and their surrounding areas, But it's the resources of our members like that, having an attorney to help do some of these things. There's a lot of possibilities. And like I say, I foresee as the time passes and more of our members get a little older, there's going to be more time spent on developing the organization.
Is there anything else that comes to mind that you would like to add?
Not at the present time, Kim.
And this concludes the interview with Mr. David Martin. Thank you.
You're welcome.